door, I had a bucket full of thoughts. When I first jumped off, I held that bucket in my hand. Ideas that would take me all around the world, I stood and watched the smoke fly. Gone and I'll never look back again. I'm gone and I'll never look back at all. You know I'll never look back again. I'll turn my face into the howling wind. It took me a long time to get back on the train.
Hi, everybody. We are live. God, I'm so happy Fish is back in concert again. Oh, man.
I mean, me
just,
too. No,
it was just like a four-day show in Mexico, but that's four new concerts to listen to.
Because you don't have several hundred already?
It's different.
I mean, I know, and I agree. And in fact, I shouldn't have brought it up, but I've already said in fact, so I've committed. I have fallen into a little bit of a Dave Matthews Band rabbit hole again. I know you're thinking to yourself, oh, did you ever leave the rabbit hole? Yes, I did. But I discovered a couple of concerts. They did a couple of shows, I think, at the same event in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, a bunch of bands play this venue. It's like, you know, there's like they do these like Cancun resorts or like Riviera Maya, and a lot of bands play it.
Fair enough. So I grabbed some Dave Matthews and Tim Reynolds acoustic. What? Who
acoustic.
Am I? Acoustic. Yeah, I don't know where that came from. At least I knew it.
That's what we used to play pool with, right?
Yeah. cool whip. Anyways, I'm really off to I'm on a roll today. So I grabbed their acoustic shows, which I have kind of half listened to as I was trying to get work done, and so those were pretty good. But I found a couple of old concerts that were interesting that I've been enjoying. So as much as I'm poking fun, Marco, I do know what you're saying. Yodological in the chat. Any mention of Fish inevitably leads to mentioning Dave Matthews. It's a fundamental law of ATP. You're not wrong.
An equal and opposite reaction.
Probably from everyone involved. And I don't just mean you and me. It's all right. It does seem like it is a dividing line between a lot of, you know, in a lot of people's minds. And as much as
good versus evil.
Oh, stop. You know, here it was. I was about to be complimentary and just say, you know, I don't like Fish as much as you do, but as much as I give you a hard time, it's not that bad at all. And here it is. You're all talking.
I don't like either one of these bands. Only one of them dumps a bunch of poop on people.
Okay. Thank you, John. You know, my favorite day of the year, I don't remember what day it is, but my favorite day of the year for the last three or four years is the anniversary of the day that the Dave Matthews Band tour bus unleashed the septic tank or whatever it's called. Marco, you would know, you're a one-time RVer, unleashed the septic tank on the people in like the architecture boat tour in Chicago. And of course, the whole of the internet needs to remind me of this event because I wasn't already
there. Fish never did anything like that. So if it's two bands, I don't like either one of their music, but I have to pick between them, I'm going to pick the one that doesn't dump poop on people.
Well, the band wasn't anywhere near the bus at the time.
I feel like they're entirely responsible. The bus probably had Dave Matthews in giant letters on the side of it. I feel like that's on them.
Was it their poop, though?
That's a good question. You might have had real honest.
at least the people in the boat could say, at least it was famous person poop. That's a great encapsulation of late stage capitalism, as they say. At least it was famous people poop. Put that on your political cartoon.
Oh, my word. Maybe we should move on. And let me ask you, John, what you doing in your living room these days?
Yeah, I had to find something to occupy my time while I was trapped in a room with COVID. I'm happy to say that today was the first day since becoming infected that I tested negative. Despite testing very, very barely positive for like 3 days in a row, today it was absolutely 100% negative. I'm zooming in on that picture. I'm like, is there anything there? I'm 100% negative.
I always shine my phone flashlight on it, different angles. Like, can I see it at all?
Yeah, so it's I'm well and truly negative today. That's great. Hopefully I'll be negative tomorrow. I'm still testing a little bit because you got to have multiple tests. Anyway, watching for that whole rebound thing. We'll see how it goes. But I needed something to do with my time. And I did watch a bunch of movies and a little bit of TV and a lot of YouTube. But I needed something to do that was interesting. And I was already in the midst of, thinking about this project. I don't know how it happened. But anyway, this project went into high gear because I had nothing else to do. And this project is to upgrade my sound system. I know we've been talking about that on the show a lot, and that's probably why it's been in the front of my mind. I recently got a fancy new TV, and with that, I got a fancy new receiver to connect to the TV, and I got a fancy new Blu-ray player. But one thing I didn't upgrade was my 5.1 speaker system, which, you know, it was cheap and old, but well reviewed when I got it. It was like, I didn't even know if I wanted a 5.1. So I'm like, I'm not going to spend a ton of money. Let me just get the, you know, best reviewed, tiny, inexpensive thing. This was many, many, many years ago. And so I've had that and it's fine, but I have upgraded the rest of my system. And now that part of it definitely looks like the weak link. And so I've been looking for months now into what could I possibly upgrade to that is nicer than this. So that's what I did during my COVID time. And it's trapped in my room for days and days on end as I just looked on YouTube and read articles and waded through audiophile forums. Those are always fun, right?
No, thank you.
The whole nine yards, just going everywhere, trying to figure out for my weird test case. I'll put a link in the show notes too. I even talked about it on Mastodon to see if anyone had any particular advice or suggestions about my weird situation. Unlike my television shopping, I feel like my speaker shopping is not applicable to most people because it's so specific to my room, my house, my scenario, my limitations. Whereas my TV is just like, other than a size that fits in my thing, it's just a big flat panel. If it's a good TV for everybody. Speakers that I ended up getting, probably not the best choice for everybody. I don't even know if they're the right choice for me, but things are on my way. And so in a future episode of the show, once everything has arrived and I've set it up, I'll give the details and go through my whole process. But for now, I just wanted to chime in and say I'm COVID negative, yay, and I spent all my time reading speaker reviews.
That sounds fun. I mean, whatever makes you happy, man. But
it did. It was surprisingly fun, although also incredibly frustrating. And again, half of that's on me. See the Mastodon thread to see what I'm dealing with here.
I feel like reading about speaker reviews, I don't know.
It's not easy. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the worst, it's so much worse than TVs, let me tell you, because TVs, it's like almost everybody agrees on what the objective measures are. There are international standards. There's equipment that will test compliance with the standards. Whereas speakers, boy, it's rough out there. Just it's on the one end, you have people who are writing poetry. It's like, okay, this does not help me. And the other end, you have people who are like, taking objective measures, but there's no sort of standardization on the like what tools you're using and does the thing that you're measuring matter at all to the experience of having the speaker. It's rough, but you know, more on that when I get this all set up, because then I'll be able to tell you if all that BS that I read ended up being helpful or not helpful at all.
I'm not trying to be funny. I'm genuinely asking, are you looking to stick with 5.1? Are you trying to go full Atmos? Is that really something?
Did you see the thread on Mastodon?
I saw that.
Do you think I have room for more speakers? The challenge I put to people says, where do you think 5.1 speakers should go in this room? And nobody even ventured to guess, like maybe one or two people, because it's grim. No, I do not have room for more speakers. I have thought about where I could fit one or two more, whether those be quote unquote height speakers or whether I would do side channels. But for now, the problem was 5.1. Replace an existing 5.1 with a better sounding 5.1. So that's what I've gone with. I have the capacity for more at any time, but for now, that's what I'm sticking with.
I don't think this is really on the table for reasons beyond your control, but are you willing to rearrange the room and like the
no,
furniture?
I mean,
room?
I didn't want to go into that on Mastodon, but like if room rearrangement, we went through all the permutations of room rearrangement like 20 years ago when we moved in. This is it. This is the room. and honestly, I don't think many rearrangements make things better except for the one where you block the fireplace with the couch, and that's not going to happen.
Well, alternatively, you could put the TV over the fireplace.
Yeah, as you know, that's not going to happen as well.
Do you use the fireplace?
No.
Have you thought about removing it?
People said that. Like, that's insane. No, I'm not going to, you know, like, I guess the anti-fireplace lobby is big because they're like, yeah, let's get rid of the fireplace. I'm like, the fireplace is like literally the best feature of my crappy house. I'm not getting, quote unquote,
use it.
Get rid of the fire. It's a nice looking thing. It's a centerpiece. If I would destroy the value of my home if I got rid of it, and I like it. I like it being there. I like looking at it. Yeah,
first
no,
of
I don't
all,
really
you
let
you
it fire
have
it.
An old home in a nice neighborhood in New England. Nothing will destroy the value of that.
No,
home.
I mean, second you know of all, like, it would reduce the value. People wouldn't. It's and ours is a good fireplace. It's not like one of those ones where the people painted over the brick. Have you seen those? Like at some point, yeah, someone got a hangover in the 60s and they painted over the brick. So bad. No, this is a good fireplace. It is, you know, I have all of our family's pictures are over it. If you remember when you were here, right? Mm-hmm. There's the big mantle, which it needs to be repainted like everything else in my house. But anyway, it's a very nice mantle. It's got all our family pictures on the wall above it, and it's a nice fireplace. And that's going to be a big house seller when it comes time to sell it. And in the meantime, I like it looking like that. So no, I'm not getting rid of the fireplace. No, I'm not putting my TV over the fireplace. No, I'm not putting one of those giant mechanical mounts where you put the TV over the fireplace.
That was my next question.
Right. Because then that would be in the way of the pictures and there'd be this big ugly mount. All of those are out. Luckily, people, you know, didn't mostly took me at my word and said, here's the room. No, this is what we've got to deal with. But none of those things are happening. So it's just a matter of working stuff. And honestly, I wouldn't want them to because it's not a home theater room. This is the main living room of our house. It needs to function first and foremost as a room where people can exist and, you know, have nice places to sit and just, you know, hang out. And if they're just looking at their phones or playing with the dog or reading or, yes, watching TV, but it is not a home theater room. So it's not like, let's rearrange the entire room and brick over the fireplace and, you know, take all your family photos off the wall and put on a giant mechanical arm to put the TV. No, that's not happening. That's not what this room is for. And that's why it's a challenge to come up with something that is acceptable to everyone involved within the draconian constraints of a 1930s house.
You should just move, man.
Yeah, just remove the fireplace. It's not hard to remove fireplaces, right? There, you can just, you know.
Well, I would say, I mean, obviously, yes, but I would say just in general, it might be healthy to think about the house that you are spending the majority of your adult life in, not as something you have to preserve for whoever's buying it next, but instead something that you should optimize no, but like for the way you actually want to live in it.
Like I said, I like the fireplace too. I like looking at it. I like how decorative it is. It feels cozy, the whole room. I even like the cruddy wallpaper that everyone in my family hates in that room, because I think it is cozy and comfy and it is a comfortable room to be in. I don't want that part of the room to change.
Fair enough. Hey, man, it's your house. It's your rules. I totally hear you. I'm going to give you a hard time about it forever because that's what we do here. But your house.
and it presents an interesting challenge, whether it's to the fancy Sony HD9, which we're going to talk about in a second, or for a plain old 5.1 system with a fancy room correction on the receiver to come up with something that works okay in that environment. Not impossible, but tricky.
Tricky indeed. But that HDA9, baby, I'm sure that'll fix your problems.
Yeah, I just wanted one more bit of feedback from MCG, another owner of the system. And they say, I have the HDA9 with the big sub and can confirm this is absolutely fantastic for movies and no complaints when we use it for TV shows. It is at its weakest for stereo music, but tracks in Apple Music with Atmos are great. As far as the complaints around dropouts, I had some initially, but the firmware updates have improved things. I don't remember the last time it happened, and I have an Eero router right next to it. Highly recommend these. So that's the magic of software-powered hardware. There's always the hope that a quote-unquote firmware update will fix your problems, and apparently, at least in the case of MCG, this happened. So that's kind of the three stories and three individual people. One saying you got to warn people off from this, one saying I've got it and sometimes it drops out but mostly it's okay, and one saying I got it and it was bad but now it's updated. I don't know what the truth is, but there you have it. All of them, the good thing is that all of them say, for its intended purpose of movies and TV with, you know, fake surround sound with speakers all over your room, it seems to work really well when it's working.
When it's working. We have a very deep cut, and I promise I'm going somewhere with this. Way in the beginning of the show, if you remember, I don't recall which came first, to be honest with you, but we had the Jonathan Mann theme song that you still hear. And we also had the Who the Hell is Casey song, which was written by an actual real life friend of mine whose name is Larry King, not the one you're thinking of, a different Larry King. Well, this is relevant to you because his band, he is in a blues band just for funsies. You know, these people all have real jobs and so on and so forth. Not that being in a band isn't a real job. You know what I'm saying? Oh, my gosh. Anyway.
We're podcasters for a living.
exactly. You know, of anyone who should be throwing stones on not having a real job, I am the last one on that list. But anyway, he and his band did a parody of I forget the name of the original song, but it's some like kind of not almost honky tonky kind of song, bluesy kind of song. It was funny, but the original is fine. But they did it, and the parody is Hot Rod Rivian, and so the entire band did their music video for this song playing in a field somewhere with all of the equipment being powered by an R1T. You know, just plugged into the back of the R1T, into the AC outlets. So my buddy Larry King writes, our sax player has a Rivian. We recorded this all while plugged into the Rivian. About 3 hours of playing took about 3% of the battery. His tuba fits in the frunk. The video is cheesy. I had nothing to do with the editing, but I did engineer all the audio. This is worth, even if it's just a few seconds of your time, it is worth it because I thought it was very well done and it gave me quite a good laugh. And my friend Larry King, who is the guitarist, is the one standing on the gear tunnel door, which I thought was also quite funny. So it is absolutely not required viewing, but it made me laugh. And like I said, this is a deep, deep cut back to Who the Hell is Casey from way back when. We'll link all of these things in the show notes.
I would also point out that if you're picturing a tuba, you are probably actually picturing a sousaphone. If you're picturing the giant thing with the giant bell that goes over the person's head as they stand and walk with it, that is a sousaphone. not a tuba. That would not fit in a Rivian Frunk. An actual tuba that was played in orchestras is a very differently shaped instrument. And it's good to hear that it fits in the Frunk, but that is less surprising than you might be thinking if you don't know the difference between a tuba and a sousaphone. Thank you. This has been Marching Band Trivia.
You took my joke. I was just going to say, tell me you were in marching band without telling me you were in marching band. All right. I would like to briefly defend my honor, or at least attempt to. The whole of the internet has written to me to explain to me that because I don't want yellow, I am part of the problem, and that fun colors can be fun. Yes, fun colors can be fun, but there are fun colors, and then there is yellow. There are other fun colors. Orange can work. Purple, when done properly, can work on a car. Yellow cannot. And that is the rules. I don't make the rules. It's just the way it is. But my point is just that just because I don't like yellow, well, first of all, it doesn't mean that you can't, as much as I joke. But secondly, there are plenty of other colorful things. My car is now blue. Let's not forget. It didn't happen to me this time. The white didn't happen to me this time.
Your car is not a fun blue, though.
Oh, pish posh.
It's a fine blue. I don't dislike it, but no one would look at that color blue and say, boy, that's a fun blue.
Fun blues have to be lighter.
Yeah.
All right.
Find some other way, like, you know, pearlescent sparkly, or, you know, turn purple in different angles of light. There's lots of things you can do that are fun, but
your blue is blue.
It's a very nice blue. It's a handsome blue.
Well, all right. I will allow it. But my point is just that, please, internet, just because I don't like yellow doesn't mean I don't like fun colors.
Is one of the most fun colors, though.
Yeah,
there are other fun colors that you like, but it's almost like you dislike the funnest, to use Apple's parlance. You dislike the funnest of fun colors.
I think you mispronounced.
Maybe purple. What's more fun than yellow? Maybe purple? I don't know.
Yeah, you have mispronounced ugly many, many times. You're pronouncing it as fun. But it's actually pronounced ugly.
Our American market cars, I don't know the rest of the world, I think it's probably the same, but American market cars are all available in black, white, silver, gray, dark gray, light gray, metallic gray, differently gray, slightly bluish gray, slightly greenish gray, slightly reddish gray. Like, there's a million different grays, whites, and blacks. And
then, except for without the black.
And then you're lucky if maybe there's, like, a red or a blue. And then that's it. There's almost every car is available in that selection. A whole bunch of grays, whites, and blacks, and maybe red and or blue.
If you're willing to pay $200,000 or more for a car, you can get really cool colors.
Right.
Each of which is a $10,000 extra.
Right. But the point is, like, I have the opportunity here to get a fun color. And most cars don't offer that opportunity. Even my Land Rover is... I have the Tasman blue color, which is... I think the only remotely fun color Land Rover offers. It's really conservative, though. It's very close to like a gray blue, if there were such a thing. It's like, it's a very restrained blue, and it's a very nice color. I think it's by far the nicest color that the Defender is available in, but it is very restrained. Rivian yellow, by all accounts and by all the videos I'm trying to watch about how it looks in real life, actually looks fun. And Rivian blue is pretty fun, too, either way. I think the yellow is more fun. And then Rivian's also available in all those boring colors. And I don't want to be boring. I want to, like, you know, how often in life do you buy cars? It's not that often.
So it seems like a lot, pretty often.
Well, but yeah. But, you know, for the most part, this is a relatively infrequent big purchase. And so, you know, I like to mix it up sometimes. I like to have more color in my life recently. And this is a way to do it.
You know, and as I said to you in the post show, and I think the bootleg might have still been running, I don't recall, but it was certainly not in the release show. I did feel a little guilty for pooping all over you. Just like, here, we're coming back to Dave Matthews again. I felt guilty for pooping all over your yellow idea, because it doesn't work for me doesn't mean it doesn't work for others. It is very much not my thing. But if you know what, if it's your thing, that's okay. So
I still feel like Rivian should be sued for their picture on their website, which looks nothing like any of the photos of this thing in real life. Almost still to the point that I have trouble believing they're trying to say it's the same color that all those owners' pictures are. But boy, those pictures on the website are worse than Apple, because sometimes Apple's photos of their subtly like brown or subtly rose colored things are different than in real life. But that car picture is nothing like the car in the photos that people take. So I feel like if anyone buys based on the website picture and then their car shows up and it's like Big Bird yellow and they thought it was going to look like the website, I feel bad for them.
It's also worth pointing out that yellow is Rivian's accent color. So no matter what color
That's
you get a
true.
Rivian in,
That's
there's
true.
Little yellow bits all over the place. And so it makes sense to go with a color that works really well with that. And
that is an annoyingly good argument,
right? And I think the second best color they have overall is the blue, but yes. I don't think the blue works as well with the yellow as I would like.
Maybe
it
not
works okay.
I think
the green looks better than the blue because it's very foresty.
Honestly, I think the one that looks the nicest, second to the yellow, is one of the grays. Like they have one of the grays that I saw in a review video that actually looked very nice with the yellow accents, but it was too boring for me. So I'm going yellow.
Right. Adam One has some feedback and clarifications on iMazing, which I believe we were talking about with regard to like backing up iMessage stuff. Adam writes, iMazing doesn't jailbreak the phone. It uses a backup file made saved to the local file system of a Mac to extract the data to export. The software lives entirely on a Mac. There are no hooks into the iPhone itself. iMazing is super handy for local backups too, if you don't want to use iCloud. It works over Wi-Fi and USB. You can also custom restore phones to only have some of the data from a backup file. It was handy when I wanted to custom restore to my new iPhone and pull over all my iMessage history, which is not synced via iCloud, to my, Adam's isn't, to my new phone while leaving all the cruft from my old phone. That allowed me to have the best of both worlds, a fresh install and the benefit of specific long-term data that I cared about. I think that's actually a really clever idea, to be honest with you, because I'm still carrying my original 3GS build, if memory serves, you know, from way back when. And most of the reason I haven't like started afresh is because I didn't want to lose all that iMessage history, because I also have not turned on iMessage in the cloud or whatever they're calling it. So that's a very clever idea. Anyway, Adam continues. When extracting messages from the backup, you can export them out as text files or PDFs. That can be super handy for legal cases and business needs. That said, it's pretty buggy and sometimes doesn't work, so you have to restart the Mac and phone periodically to get things working again. Overall, it has been worth having the tool to help me manage my data without using iCloud. So there you go. John, tell me about your Apple TV remote with touch enabled. Or disabled? Enabled. Tell me about it, one way or the other.
Yeah, so I had disabled it because I was sick of thinking that I was accidentally moving my thumb a millimeter and causing the Apple TV to freak out, and I really just wanted to eliminate it as a factor. So now when I hit the center button on the Apple TV remote and it does something ridiculous, I can say, well, it's not because of the touchpad, because I turned that off. It's a setting in, you know, Apple TV setting things where you can make it so it just does clicks. And I had it that way for a little bit, and I was using it, and I was, you know, of course, swiping on the pad and realizing it doesn't work and then going to use the little D-pad thing. But there is a fatal flaw with this arrangement, at least a fatal flaw when I was trapped in my room with COVID. When I'm trapped in my room, you learned how much my family needs my help to use the equipment in the house, because they just remind me of everything. So they're FaceTiming me and texting me and yelling up at me, oh, I can't do this thing on TV. How do you do that? Or whatever. And here's a place where I tried to help them remotely and I couldn't. And so I had to have them re-enable touch. What do you think it was?
I have no idea. Do they do the scrubbing thing?
So much more fundamental than that. Think really
scrolling.
Think about how bad Apple TV is.
Just like scrolling between things to choose them?
No. Okay. Here we go. So they were trying to use an app on the Apple TV, and of course, it doesn't work. And what happened was the app was so hosed that it was just plain frozen. And you could go back to the home screen, and then you could go back to the app, and I think they know how to do that.
Oh, but
it didn't matter, because when
up.
You come back to the app, it just wouldn't do anything. It was just absolutely 100% locked up, frozen. No button did anything, right? You could not play. You couldn't go back. You couldn't go forward. You couldn't do anything. They needed to force quit that app.
And you had to swipe up.
And they said, how do we force quit? Force quitting isn't working. And I realized I had disabled touch. Normally you go to the multitasking switcher by hitting the little TV looking button twice. And then you pick the app you want and you swipe up. And honestly,
did they know that? Because no one knows that.
Oh, they know that because we have Apple TV and they see me do it all the time, because these apps, it's not the first time an app is locked up on the Apple TV, let me tell you. Or sometimes it just gets into a wonky mode and you need to force quit it. This is force quitting the correct way, which is when the app you're trying to use no longer works, force quit that sucker and try to get it to work. And there may be a way to force quit without using the touchpad. In fact, there has to be. There has to be a way. But when I'm trapped up in my room with COVID and my family's yelling at me, I just said, just re-enable touch.
I'm going to guess, by the way, it's probably, I bet when you're in the multitasking switcher and you're over the app, instead of swiping up, I bet if you like press or hold one of the buttons, maybe like the play
pause
button.
I haven't
done
that. I mean, I made a couple of good guesses. Yeah. I tried holding up. I tried having them hold the main button down. Like, I'd have them try to do a whole bunch of stuff that's what I would have done if I was there.
Like the play pause or something weird.
Yeah. Whatever it is, after one or two guesses of me trying to say, let's try this, like the thing you just suggested and a few others, those didn't work. And so I had to just give up and say, just re-enable the touch. I didn't bother Googling to find out the answer. I'm sure if there's a way to force quit without touch enabled, someone will tell us and we'll put it in follow-up next week. But there you go. An essential feature of the Apple TV remote that you need touch to be able to do, unless you know how to do it without touch, which I don't.
Fun.
Force quit. The most important feature on the Apple TV.
Oh, I'm an Apple TV apologist. I feel bad for you making fun of me.
How many times have you had your family trying to watch TV and the app freezes solid?
Well, all right. I'm going to answer your question by saying I know for a fact that Declan knows how to do this very dance. So,
wow.
So, yeah.
So that, I mean, he is 8
he
now,
needs to force quit everything because he's a youngster.
Well, yeah, right.
They just need to go through and just by matter of course. Well, it's like their idle animation. It just, you put any device in their hand and then they're bored. They just go, bop, for, quote unquote, force quitting those photos of applications last launched a year ago. But it's really important to swipe those upwards.
Oh, my word.
My parents do it. And they'd say, I know these aren't running apps. I know they're just pictures. I just like to not have the pictures there, which, as I said in the past, not having the pictures there is a legit user need that is not being met by Apple. But that is combined. Not having the pictures there and force quitting applications are both the same thing as far as the UI is concerned. Some of them you're force quitting, but most of them you're removing pictures.
Do people know, by the way, the Apple Watch version of force quitting? Know that.
I bet you do.
Know, it's funny you bring that up because I just tried to do this the other day. What was it? I don't remember, but I thought, and you're going to correct me, I thought it was hold down on the bigger of the two buttons. Yeah. I forget what that's called.
Hold down the big button until you get the like lock screen.
Right.
And then
I thought
the home
after
button
that,
for a couple, or then I'll hold the crown for a couple seconds and it kills the app.
That's what I thought. And maybe I was doing something wrong. Maybe I was holding it wrong. Who knows? But at the time it was not working.
You can go into the app switcher by hitting the side button and then just swipe to the left so that it gets a little card out of the way. That's a faster way to do it.
I don't think I knew that one actually. That's interesting. Huh. Well, now I've learned something.
Real time follow up from the chat room. Apparently force quit without touch enabled is double tap up. Like on the D-pad, tap, tap.
Interesting.
Instead of swiping upwards, instead of holding upwards, double tap up quickly. Haven't tried this, haven't confirmed, but that is what the chat room says.
I mean, I would believe it, but yeah, that's still crummy. By the way, did anyone else in the house come down with COVID?
Nope. So far, no. And since I'm negative, I think we're probably in the clear.
Nice.
So my isolation and constant reading of speaker reviews seems to have worked.
You have done the family a service. I see how it is. All right. Some more information about the Apple TV. I don't want to read this because I like the Apple TV, darn it. David Bokey writes, I wanted to let you know that Apple's own apps are not immune to bad behavior. I was watching The Last of Us on HBO via the Hulu app, and my daughter had to step out of the room, so we paused. I then started watching a show on Apple TV Plus. My daughter came back, and I switched back to Hulu. When The Last of Us was over, and I switched back to my Apple TV show, and found that the playhead was 23 minutes further into the Apple TV Plus show than when I left it. It kept playing while I was in the Hulu app. I wonder if they are also getting bad metric data on usage, and if this is more widespread.
This is another fun thing of like, you know, should an application be able to play when it's not showing anything on the screen? It seems like something that shouldn't happen. It seems like a pretty baseline level of competence. Like the app that is not filling the screen with its image should not be playing, but apparently it was.
Cool. All right. So we have a little bit more about the diabetes and blood glucose monitoring. Jenger writes, because I work in tech, I was able to pay out of my own pocket for a continuous glucose monitor, in my case, the Dexcom G6. Which cost me about £170 per month, or about $205, or approximately £2,000, or roughly $2,400 a year, every year, forever. Yikes.
Yeah, so the cost of an Apple Watch that could theoretically do this would be peanuts compared to the existing ones on the market.
Yeah, definitely. Scott Jen writes, the Freestyle Libre continuous glucose monitor costs on the order of $300 and lasts for 2 weeks. And needs to be completely replaced, and it gives you a glucose reading every 15 minutes and has a buffer of something like 6 hours. So as long as you copy the data to your phone every few hours, you don't miss anything. And it uses NFC. You just tap your phone on it and it copies the data. They're also prescription only in the US, so you may have to pay for a doctor visit as well. The price of a watch is absolutely worth it to save pricking your finger, get continuous data, or not needing to bother a doctor every 2 weeks. For all three, if Apple can pull it off, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, the price of a lot of these continuous glucose monitors are really expensive for multiple reasons. One, they're you know, a quote unquote prescription product that has a market that has tons of regulation in it, so there's not a lot of competitors. And two, all those regulations that they have to comply with do end up making the product cost more money because it's very difficult. It's become slightly less difficult, I think, over time, but very difficult to actually comply to be a certified medical device that could kill people if it malfunctions. And so you pay for that privilege. And then also a bunch of the other ones, they have consumables, like the little patch you put on. Those patches don't last forever. If they last like 10 days or whatever, and you're, if you're lucky, they last 10 days. And then you got to peel them off and you got to put a new one in because they just wear out. Like the sticky stuff wears out and the thing, they're not supposed to be in that long, right? So there's consumables with things that are invasive, as in they shove something under your skin. And then they're just expensive. You know, all that stuff is expensive because it's a... It's not like a, you know, competitive consumer electronics market type thing. It's more of a medical device. It's like if you ever tried to buy good quality, you know, crutches or good quality walker or a good quality wheelchair, that stuff's really expensive too. And that is much lower bar in terms of compliance and regulation than one of these devices. The other thing is that we didn't really mention last time is the thing that Apple is trying to come up with is a thing that would monitor your glucose levels. But they're not coming up with a way to put insulin into your body without a non-invasive insulin injection system would be even more fantastical. So, you know, based on that information, you will need to get insulin into yourself somehow. And whether that's the old fashioned shots or the fancy, insulin pumps that go into your, you know, under your skin or into your body, whatever, and then dispense the correct amount of insulin, that's still going to be there. And that's why I still say like the, you know, the, if you had a fantasy scenario, curing diabetes would be ideal. So you don't need anything shoved into your body. But eliminating one half of that, which is to not have to shove things into your self somewhere to get blood glucose readings would be fantastic for a lot of people. And then the cost of these are expensive things means that even though a watch would be expensive, it would still be cheaper. My point last time about the cost of the watch is that this is a non-invasive thing in theory that Apple comes up with. And unlike the invasive ones where I feel like not that people are happy to pay them, but I think people kind of understand that, hey, if you're getting something that shoves itself under your skin and that there's a bunch of regulations around that because it's a, you know, it's a more invasive device than a watch versus a thing you just put on that has some sensors in it. Right. That's why I feel like Apple would be experiencing price pressure because they did come up with this miraculous thing. People would expect it to be less expensive because it is less invasive. Right. In the same way that the blood oxygen monitor you can buy from CVS is inexpensive because the tech in it's not complicated and it's quote unquote non-invasive. Yeah, it clamps on your finger, but it's literally just a little light, right? And people are going to see the Apple Watch and say, I don't care about titanium. I don't care about the quartz crystal glass. I don't care about the fancy processor that can, you know, do all these amazing things. I just want the tiny sensor and the algorithm that you came up with. And I don't want to pay $500 for it. So that's why I feel like there would be price pressure on Apple to make that innovation available more widely, even though all those same people are still paying either out of pocket or with a little bit of help from insurance, way more money for the invasive system, simply because I think it is more reasonable for an invasive system to cost more because it is more fraught, let's say, more complicated. Whereas if you come up with a non-invasive solution, it seems like it should be less expensive, unless it uses like, you know, whatever crystals from Star Trek to get the measurements.
Dilithium, is that what you're
saying? There you go. Thank you.
And a few other things in the diabetes and glucose monitoring that we heard. We had a lot of feedback from a lot of people who know way more than we do about this, including many people with diabetes, people who have worked on equipment for diabetes and things like that. And so, you know, obviously, again, our audience comes through really nicely with, you know, a lot of very deep specialized knowledge. So thanks for all that. And a few of the highlights that we didn't cover yet, basically, There's many different ways to measure blood glucose, even with the existing sensors. I was wrong about something. I want to follow up that the continuous glucose monitors, I said they have a half-inch needle sticking out that has to stay in your skin the whole time. Turns out it doesn't stay in your skin the whole time, that it basically inserts like a little wire into your skin, and that little wire stays in your skin the whole time, but the needle just pops right out.
Lots of people will send that information. It's like, I understand that is technically correct, but it's not like people's objection is to, oh, I don't want a needle in my skin. I want a little tube.
Well, I was happy because, like, you know, because like when my dog had to wear one of those, it was the Freestyle Libra or whatever. When he had to wear one of those, I felt so bad for him that he had this thing in him the whole like week.
But he does; it's just not a needle. It's just a different thing,
right? But it's at least not as bad.
I know people, but the point is, all these things. The reason they're called invasive is because they shove something into your skin. And yes, a needle helps it get there, and then the needle goes away, maybe, right? But the thing is still in your skin. That's why it's invasive. So it's not like when you prick your finger, which is horrible for its own reason, you prick it with a needle, but then the needle goes away, and then you just squeeze blood out of your finger, which sucks, right? But the things that go into your skin, whether there's a needle involved or not, something is under your skin the whole time that's there. And the whole point is that thing that's under your skin is very small, very light, not pointy, very slippery. Like, it's made to be as comfortable as possible, but there's still something under your skin. So everyone was very quick to say, there's not a needle under your skin. There's something else under your skin. But forget about that. It's not a needle. I agree. It's better than a needle, but it's still, quote unquote, invasive because there's something sticking into you.
Yeah. But I think so there were two big themes of feedback that I found unexpected. I didn't know. So one of them is that those continuous monitors are not measuring in the bloodstream directly. They're measuring in like subcutaneous, like, you know, skin and tissue layers. And so it actually is kind of a delayed or like less precise measurement. And secondly, I learned that I assume once I heard that insulin pumps existed and that continuous monitors existed, I assumed that what most, at least type 1 people with diabetes were doing was having the monitor automatically dose the insulin pump, creating what is called an artificial pancreas, effectively. And it turns out, based on the feedback, it sounds like that's not actually that common. And there's actually this whole world of hacking where people are like hacking the monitor's radio protocols to intercept the data and like, you know, run the pump possibly manually or at least get the data out so it's less proprietary or whatever else. That's a whole world that I didn't know about. But basically, that, you know, the thing is, like, if you think about the risk factors here, if somebody with diabetes gives themselves too much insulin, they die. And too little insulin, I don't know if you can die from too much blood sugar. You probably can at some point, but at least it has
very
problems.
Terrible health effects, and you will eventually kill you. I'm not sure if it kills you as fast as overdosing on insulin.
Yeah, it has other problems at least, but yeah, have too much insulin and you're dead. And so this is something that you don't want to be left to a system that is potentially flaky or imprecise. And there's obviously huge high bars to clear for anything that is approved for medical use to do automatic dosing. And so there's kind of the separation of, like, all right, you can have monitoring, and if you don't want to go full artificial pancreas mode, which has those big risks, you can have monitoring, but you just use that as like information to decide for yourself how much insulin to dose.
So this kind of reminds me of the AI copyright thing. Like, I really do wonder if that really absolves anyone from any kind of responsibility. It's like, well, our insulin pump didn't kill you. You're a faulty measurement with some other device from another manufacturer. You're a lousy pinprick with your little test strips or whatever. It was your choice, person, to decide to dose yourself with this much insulin. So technically, you made the mistake, not us, and our insulin pump isn't at fault. But then they would say, okay, but then what about whatever system I use to measure my, you know, blood glucose level? The point of that system is it's supposed to give me an accurate measure that I can take action based on, and it gave me a wrong measure or a bad measure. So somebody's responsible somewhere, because it's not as if the person magically knows their own blood glucose level. They're using some kind of tool or product they bought from somebody that is supposed to be for that purpose. And I kind of understand the pump people not getting into it, because they're like, hey, we're just a pump. We just do whatever you tell us. Like, if you typed in these numbers, we're going to do that. And as long as we did what you told us, we're not liable. But somebody's liable. And so if whether that's the resistance to the closed loop thing, or it's, you know, like, so I feel like just because the person made the choice to enter that into the pump, if the company that makes the pump also makes the thing that gave them the measurement that made them type that in, putting a person in the middle doesn't like absolve anybody from responsibility. I feel like it's still just a question of who was negligent here or whose product, you know, malfunctioned.
Well, and so that's why I think what Apple is most likely to do, if they can get this to work and therefore be able to be made into a product feature, I think that what they will probably do, at least first and possibly forever, is similar to what they've done. If you look at, you know, like the heart monitoring features and things like that, they're not really meant for people who have chronic heart problems for the most part. It's not giving you like high-end diagnoses. It isn't giving you like a lot of real-time actionable information that you need if you have like special heart needs. It is giving you kind of an overview and warning of extreme conditions. And so I think what they're going to do here is actually design, again, assuming this feature even ships eventually, actually design it so that it is not very useful to a person with diabetes. because if you think about what I think they're going to do here, because of the inherent imprecision in what they're probably going to do compared to anything that's actually measuring your blood, and combined with the delay that it would probably have based on being probably based more like the continuous ones, where like you're not seeing everything exactly as it happens, I bet what they're going to do is delay the stats from it. The same way right now with the ovulation detection, they give you ovulation detection like after the fact. They look at your temperature pattern, you know, over the last whatever, and they tell you after the fact, oh, by the way, it looks like you ovulated or whatever. Remember when they launched a feature last fall with the Watch Series 8? Like they called it something like, you know, retrospective something something. I bet they're going to start with that with this feature, where they might not tell you right now your blood glucose is this, but they might tell you, here's what your blood glucose was 12 hours ago or 6 hours ago, and then let you build data from that of like, oh, okay, whatever I had for lunch, that probably was a bad idea or whatever. And then secondly, from that, maybe they will also warn you of extreme conditions. So if it's way too high or way too low, maybe they'll tap you and alert you of that. But I don't see them getting into the real-time glucose monitoring business yet, you know, in version one, if ever, just because once you realize like what that involves with FDA clearance and legal liability and the risk of people's lives if it goes wrong, I don't think Apple's going to want to get into that far. I think they're going to want to hit the more broad health benefits of extreme condition monitoring and kind of delayed glucose monitoring, so that you can, you know, make different decisions about, you know, maybe your diet or your habits or whatever, but you're not using this thing to replace a medical device that you actually need if you actually have diabetes.
Finally, I made a kind of offhanded comment, I almost said yesterday, last week, with regard to Sonos stuff. And my impression at the time was that unless you like add the Amazon Lady in the Tube to your Sonos setup, then that you couldn't call out like, you know, hey, Dingus, play Mute Math or whatever the case may be. And I have been corrected a couple of times. I think Dan Provost was actually the first person to say something. It turns out this is possible, and I will link to the Sonos voice control information page, like marketing page on their website. I only had the chance to try this very briefly, and honestly, it was a little bit hit or miss. But I had thought incorrectly that all you could do was like move music or, you know, audio between rooms, you know, say join audio here and there or whatever, or, you know, stop, volume up, volume down, etc. But it turns out you can actually call out a request and it will do its best to play that request from, you know, Spotify, Apple Music, whatever the case may be. So that is my mistake. And you should look into this a little more if you're at all interested.
My poor Google Home had a rare instance of Siri brain the other day. I said, you know, okay, Dingus, lights out. And it waited a little while and it said something very Siri-like, was like, lights out is not available for playing right now, or something as if it was looking for a song called, and there's got to be 1,000 songs called Lights Out. So maybe it just couldn't connect to the internet or whatever, but it was like, oh man, what's going on? She's hanging out with Siri too much. Normally it's just does what I ask immediately. And it gave me and so I asked Siri to do it. That's why you got to have multiple cylinders, because you never know when some cylinder is going to betray you.
Wow. All right. So let's see here. There has been, speaking of betraying, there's been a big brouhaha over the last couple of days after Joanna Stern and Nicole Nguyen, I hope I pronounced that somewhat close to correctly, they wrote a bit of a bombshell article, and as always with Joanna Stern, had a genuinely stellar video associated with it. She is so good on video. It kind of makes me mad that she can be so good in print and also so good in video. It's not fair. But anyway, there's been a lot of reporting done around this, mostly by Joanna and Nicole, where and the problem is, a lot of people, particularly in bigger cities, particularly outside bars, particularly in the evening, particularly presumably after having a couple of alcoholic beverages, they're finding that their iPhones are getting stolen, which in and of itself stinks. But it's happening subsequent to the thief or part of the thief's crew shoulder surfing their passcode. So said differently, you know, I'm out at the bar. I type in my, you know, 12345 password, passcode. Somebody sees me do that. And then later on in the evening grabs my phone, knowing full well that my passcode is 12345. This is a big freaking problem, because that means that the second they get the phone, they can, you know, change your iCloud password. They can turn off Find My Phone and many, many other things. They can send themselves money with Venmo, PayPal, or Cash App. They can go into your banking app, and oftentimes they can go ahead and send themselves money from there. You know, once you have your passcode, they have control over biometrics. They can change the biometrics and remove the biometrics, etc. It's really, really bad. So reading from the article, with only the iPhone and its passcode, an interloper can within seconds change the password associated with the iPhone owner's Apple ID. This would lock the victim out of their account, which includes anything stored in iCloud. The thief can also often loot the phone's financial apps, since the passcode can unlock access to all the device's stored passwords. This is, as a side, this is particularly bad when you're using iCloud Keychain, which I'm not trying to say that iCloud Keychain is bad, but if you've already got the key to your iOS kingdom, then you've gotten, you know, you have access to this interloper, as I said, has access to your iCloud keychain, and then you know, you're off to the races. Continuing from the article, a similar vulnerability exists in Google's Android mobile operating system. However, the higher resale value of iPhones makes them a far more common target, according to law enforcement officials. And a lot of times there'll be a story like this and everyone get up in arms. Oh, look at this. Apple's just not even caring, not even trying. I don't think that's what this is at all. I think this is just a crummy set of circumstances. Like, I'm all for slagging on Apple if they are being negligent, but I don't personally think that's the case here at all. I mean, there's only but so much they can do if somebody has grabbed your passcode and your phone. Like, I think there, and we'll talk about some mitigation strategies here in a second, but I don't think this is negligence on Apple's part. And the problem is, you know, as with all things, the more secure you make things, the less convenient they tend to be. And, you know, some of these fixes that we'll talk about here in a minute make some stuff less convenient. And Apple has to ride the fine line between making it easy enough for a power user like me, who is maybe willing to have a much harder time doing things or willing to jump through more hoops, versus my parents, who are not dumb by any means and are pretty tech savvy for, you know, being nearly 70 years old. But nevertheless, you know, they don't want to have to jump through 3,000 hoops in order to do a lot of the stuff that a passcode requires. So I don't know. This does not strike me as one of those things where it's a brouhaha made out of nothing, but it also doesn't strike me as Apple being negligent either. I don't know.
A historical hangover, don't you feel like? Because, I mean, remember when the iPhone first came out, there wasn't even a passcode. You just slide the little thing on the bottom and it unlocks. Yeah, so different age, obviously, right? And then for a long time, when they had the passcode feature, it was, you know, short and most people didn't use it. And we've kind of worked our way up from there. And I feel like, well, first of all, this vulnerability has existed for ages. This is not a new thing or whatever. And I think the reason it's existed is because they ended up in a situation where the passcode, this thing that, you know, first there was nothing, then there was passcode, and then passcode got bigger. And then, you know, we just built up this whole big security infrastructure, but the passcode was always there. And I think they just let it go. You know, things that were okay years and years ago, like having no passcode, were allowed to live too long. And I think the thing that was allowed to live too long here is that the unlock code from your phone can do just one or two too many things. Because yes, it unlocks your phone or whatever, but the fact that you can do stuff like change your Apple ID password from your phone without knowing the old Apple ID password, as long as you know the passcode, seems like a bit much. And you could say, oh, that's actually good because people forget their Apple ID password and they can change it from the phone. Like, I understand the utility of that feature, but it seems like something that sort of accidentally happened because, you know, the keys to your iCloud kingdom were your passcode, was when they added iCloud to phones, and then you had your passcode to unlock it. And it just seemed like, well, why would we make them enter their password? They're already on their quote unquote trusted device and they know their passcode, so we shouldn't ask them for any more, right? But certain things are irreplaceable. And the thing that really gets me about this is not even so much people stealing money or sending stuff, like, because a lot of the times, you know, you can go through fraud, you can have file a fraud request with the bank, and you know, if it's a credit card or whatever, yeah, you might lose some money. But in general, it's actually more difficult than you think to like take huge amounts of money from someone without giving them any recourse, especially in the age of credit cards and all that other stuff, right? And even with debit cards, like, it's hard to transfer large amounts without you know, firing up a flag or having your bank stop it or whatever. The thing that really kills me about these thefts is if someone gets your phone and can use your little passcode to change your Apple ID and to lock you out of your Apple ID. And often if they lock you out and, you know, even if the thief gets caught and arrested and goes to jail or whatever, you may still never get your Apple ID back, because the whole point of the security is that Apple doesn't have a magic internal key to unlock all your stuff. If they change your password and or they deleted everything from your thing or whatever, like, you may never get that Apple ID back. And what's associated with the Apple ID? Photos, your family photos. I think the person in the video was like, lost their phone and they lost like, you know, 15 years worth of photos, right? And for most people, that's the only place they have them. I know if you're listening to this show, of course you have 17 copies of your iCloud photo library, and it's on backups and it's on a time machine, it's on your Synology, it's on an external disk, it's, you backed up to Backblaze, but you're not like most people. Most people, like, it's literally just quote unquote on their phone. And they think it's safe because they're like, oh, I dropped my phone in a lake a year ago and I got a new phone, all my pictures are still there. And it just gives them this amazing confidence that their pictures are safe. Well, if a thief gets your phone and they change your Apple ID password, you may never see those photos again. If you don't have those photos anywhere else, that's it. They're gone. Because they're still there in some, you know, S3 server somewhere, but they're protected by a password on an iCloud account that you're never going to get back. And that is terrible. That is not replaceable. You can't file a fraud request or whatever with your bank to say, hey, someone stole my thing. No one can give you those pictures back. So yes, that's why you should have backups, but also that's why the sort of iCloud Apple ID takeover is something that should not be possible by shoulder surfing somebody's 1234 unlock code, because that's a bridge too far. Yes, they can take over your phone. Yes, maybe they can get into your apps, although the good banking apps will require Face ID and won't let you use a passcode. Yes, maybe they'll get into your passwords or whatever, but they're in this type of situation where it's a race then for you to quickly change all your passwords or log everybody out of all of your things or whatever. But none of those things are they're all annoying and terrible and can really screw with your life. But none of those things are as valuable as your whole lives or the photos of all your kids. Like, people who are, you know, much younger than I am, the only photos they have are digital photos. And all those photos are on their phone and they're not making backups, because who the heck make backups? Or they think the iCloud is their backup. Well, guess what? When someone owns your Apple ID and you can't get that Apple ID back ever, all those photos are gone. If you're lucky, maybe you have a Mac where you have a local cache copy of them. And if you're lucky, you know how someone knows enough to how to get them back without, you know, getting locked out of your Apple ID when it tries to sync with iCloud. Like, it's grim, right? So I feel like the passcode on your phone should not allow you to be owned that hard. It should, particularly, you should not be able to take over an Apple ID because you know 1234. And the authentication where they say, oh, it's two-factor, we'll send you a thing. Well, they're going to send it to your phone and not SMS. Apple has their own like two-factor thing. Like, that's going to let them get through too. But I feel like you should have to know your password to reset your password. Now, I'm sure someone who works in Apple support is going to say, we can't do that. If we did that, no one would ever be able to reset their password, because they forget their password and they want to use their phone to get out of it. Or they want, you know, there needs to be an easier way. So I feel for Apple in the situation, one more thing. This is why Touch ID and Face ID are great, because they let you not have to enter your unlock code. They can't steal your face or your fingerprint as easily. So far, thieves haven't figured that out. But shoulder surfing your 1234 is trivial, right? In a crowded bar, you have no idea who's over your shoulder. Your screen's lit up or whatever. And it's like, why would anybody type in their passcode? Well, what if you're wearing a mask? What if the Face ID doesn't work because you're wearing a scarf or a hat or someone's especially in the age of COVID and all these masks, even though, yes, Face ID supposedly works with a mask, sometimes it just doesn't unlock. Sometimes you just want to check out the grocery store and it doesn't read with your mask and you just do enter passcode and you type it in, right? Being shoulder surfed is more of a risk now than before. But all of those technologies, Face ID and Touch ID, and improving them and making them work with masks is a mitigation against this kind of attack, because it is harder for run-of-the-mill thieves to do that than it is for someone to look over your shoulder and see your passcode. So I feel like what Apple has to do here is what they've already been doing, which is keep working on methods of authentication that are not typing in a stupid code that, you know, that's too short or whatever, because, you know, no one types the really long one. We'll get to that in a second. And then also, if at all possible, make it so that you cannot, solely with the phone and 1234, lock someone out of their Apple ID for good by changing their Apple ID password. Like, that's how you lock somebody out. If you change their password, now they don't know the password, but you do. They're never going to get back in again, and all their photos belong to you.
Yeah, I think what you know, what we can do in the short term is, you know, raise awareness of this vulnerability, because, like, I was on the talk show and I said some of this already, so forgive me if you heard both. What came as a huge surprise to me is that you can change an Apple ID password if you have the passcode to a logged in phone. That I had no clue that was possible. And there's a mitigation of that, which we'll get to in a second. But that's good that we know that now, because I think most people, you know, as you're going through John's history of the universe there of, like, you know, before we had passcodes and everything, you know, most people don't fully realize how much is at risk if somebody takes over your entire Apple account and has one of your logged in devices. Like, there is so much at risk now in your life if that happens, that I feel like we have to treat that pretty carefully. We have to guard that very well. The same way we would guard, like, you know, the possessions in our house. You know, like, hey, lock the door at night. You know, that kind of thing. You know, but most people, I don't think, treat their phone with that level of security. And especially their passcode, because most people just think if you know the passcode, oh, I guess you get to, like, play on my phone without me knowing it if you steal my phone also. But you don't also think you are going to be able to take over my entire Apple account and also lock me out of it. So I think it's useful. Like what I've done in response to this, of learning this, is I've gone back to an alphanumeric passcode, like just
same.
A password, because I had left it during COVID because I kept having to go grocery shopping with masks. And, you know, this was before Face ID with mask support. And so it was a huge pain in the butt. And so I switched back to a numeric code for that. But now I switched back to the password style code because, you know, number one, it's more secure. But number two, and I think this is the bigger one, it when I'm entering a password into a password field, I kind of just automatically, inherently treat it like something more secure physically to the world around me. So I'm not going to, like, type in a password into my phone in a way that I think other people can easily overlook, you know, look over my shoulder and see it, or see it from across the room or whatever. You know, I might hold the phone closer to me. I might just not do it for that time and just put it back in my pocket and do it later. You know, I would take better physical precautions kind of automatically or habitually when something looks like a password, as opposed to this, you know, a six-digit code that you type on these giant buttons and it's so easy to do that you do it a million times a day. You know, most people who I see typing in their passcode, you know, on a routine basis, usually it's people who don't routinely let Face ID or Touch ID work for them. Either it doesn't work for them, or they just instantly go to type in the passcode because it has failed them in the past and they don't trust it anymore. And when your passcode is really easy and it's just a couple of numbers to type in, it's easier to get into that habit. If your passcode is a password that's, you know, non-trivial, then you're going to be much more likely to rely more on the biometrics whenever possible. And, you know, if the biometrics aren't working for a long time and you're having to type in your password all the time, maybe instead of just abandoning Face ID, maybe you'll, like, retrain Face ID, like reset it, or something like that. Because that's a huge problem. I don't know if Apple's ever going to really get, you know, everyone to trust the biometrics, but one of the best things they can do is make the biometrics work for more people. And I don't just mean make it possible to work. I mean make them compelling so that there are fewer and fewer people over time who refuse to use them and just type in their, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 every time they open their phone. Because if the passcode has – because of the amount of power the passcode has that, again, most people don't realize. But the amount of power the passcode has, Apple needs to really try as much as – and I know they do, but as much as they possibly can – to try to make sure no one is sticking with typing in 1111, you know, 1,000 times a day in all kinds of places in public every single time they take their phone out.
Yeah, that's why the Face ID with mask is so important. Like, yes, as we talked about when they did, it does decrease the security. There's less of a face that you're identifying or whatever, but it is still preferable to people typing in 1, 2, 3, 4, right? And alphanumeric passcode, like, that is in our list of mitigations here. That's the first one on the list. That's a definite mitigation. It's harder to shoulder surf, whether it's because of your body posture, like Marco said, or just because of the plain fact that presumably your alphanumeric passcode is not 1, 2, 3, 4. Like, it's like just making an alphanumeric doesn't solve any problems other than giving you a tiny keyboard to type on. You actually have to make it longer and more complicated. Of course, nobody wants to do that. So this is the most difficult solution. And if you go with the Marco solution, it's like, oh, it's a perverse incentive. I hate it so much. I will avoid it whenever possible, and I'll use biometrics. As we talked about in the past, apparently old people can't use Touch ID because their fingerprints are too non-consistent, which is rough. But I think Face ID should work about as well for everybody, including older people. So, you know, but again, it's just a question of like, oh, well, it failed me once or twice, and now I give up on it because it's newfangled. Because people blame themselves, especially people who are less familiar with technology. They blame themselves. They think, I'm doing something wrong. It makes me feel bad when I stare at this rectangle and it just blinks at me and gives me some kind of error that I don't understand. It makes me not want to do that because I feel like I'm failing. I'm failing to use the device, right? And that doesn't feel good. And it's like, well, you know what? I could type 1, 2, 3, 4 every single time. I'm familiar with the touchpad button. It's a technology that was created in my lifetime when I went from rotary dial to, you know, touch tone dialing. I made that transition when I was 30, and now I'm comfortable with it. And so I'm not even going to bother with Face ID. And it is Apple's challenge to get those people on board. And every time they make Face ID faster, for it to work on more angles, for it to work with a mask on, like, that is all an attempt to get those people on board. You're not going to get everybody all the time, but that's why I commend Apple's efforts to try to make Face ID the go-to option, despite the fact, like I said, I think they should clamp down on the power of the passcode, which I feel like is just sort of an inherited advantage because in the beginning, that's all there was. And now there's so much more, but the passcode has retained its power. It's retained the keys to the kingdom, and maybe it's time to think about taking them away. The second mitigation here is use a different password manager. This is for the mitigation on people not getting your passwords. It doesn't help with your Apple ID because, again, the passcode is going to give you access to that, right? But if you don't want it to have all the passwords to all your different websites, don't use Apple's iCloud keychain, because once they get into your Apple ID, they have access to your iCloud keychain, which is where your passwords are, and they can look them all up. I mean, someone could shoulder surf your 1Password password as well, but again, presumably that's harder, depending if you have a long alphanumeric thing for that. That is an advantage of having sort of a not putting all your eggs in one basket. The disadvantage is that it's a little bit more complicated and potentially more costly than using the Apple solution. So I'm glad Apple builds in iCloud Keychain, and I'm glad they continue to enhance it support the timed authentication code stuff and cloud syncing and eventually pass keys. All that's great. But if someone cracks your Apple ID, they own all that stuff too.
Yay.
And then the final thing that you can do to mitigate this, which is what I've actually done, and I think pretty much everybody listening to the show should do, because there's not a lot of downsides and it directly addresses the vulnerability, is we'll get to this in the after show, I suppose, but to use this screen time feature, which is a feature to try to limit people, presumably in a family, how much time they spend in various applications. You can add content restrictions. It's like, oh, this is for kids, so they're not on YouTube late at night. Haha, what kid would do that? But as the family organizer or whatever they call it, or even as an adult, you can enable screen time on your own phone, whether it's to try to train yourself not to use Twitter too much, which we talked about in the past, not much of an issue anymore, or whatever it is you want to do. You can set up screen time on your own phone and put limits on it. And it's like, well, why would I want to do that? What's the point of that? It might be a fun thing for you to do to shape your own habits. But also you can add a screen time passcode, which is mostly, you think that's mostly there so the kids can't go to the settings and screen time and like disable all their restrictions because they don't know your screen time passcode. Well, guess what? Your screen time passcode can be different than your phone's unlock code. So what you do is you go into screen time, you enable it in setting screen time, and then you set a screen time passcode and make it different than your phone passcode. I think it's limited to 4 digits, so it's not great, but set a screen time passcode that you will remember and make it different than your phone lock thing on your own phone. Now, obviously, like, what's the point of that? You can always unlock it, because if you get annoyed by some, setting, you can just go into screen time and disable the passcode, because it'll say, okay, you want to turn off the passcode? Type it in, and you'll type it in, and it will disable it. It's not to stop you, it's to stop the thief. And then the final thing you do is, in setting screen time, go to enable content privacy restrictions. That's like the big switch at the very top of the screen. And then after you turn that on, all the options below it in the screen will be enabled. Scroll, scroll, scroll until you see an option called account changes. And you want to change that to don't allow. So you're using screen time to stop your quote unquote yourself from doing one specific thing, which is making changes to your account. Once you do that, then if the thief gets your phone and they unlock it with their with your passcode that they shoulder surfed. When they go to change your Apple ID password, it will say, Screen Time says you're not allowed to make changes to your account. And if they go try to disable Screen Time, it'll say, please enter your Screen Time passcode, which they did not shoulder surf from you, because why are you ever going to be entering your Screen Time passcode ever? Because the only restriction you put on it is account changes, right? Now, there may be ways around Screen Time restrictions. Clever thieves will figure it out. Clever thieves will get your stuff no matter what. Like, it's tough. But like, the run-of-the-mill thief will be thwarted by an additional four-digit code that they don't know. And so until and unless it becomes well known how to get around this particular restriction of Screen Time, you can stop someone from totally taking over your Apple ID by enabling Screen Time, setting a passcode on it, and then turning off account changes. Oh, and by the way, when you set the thing, it will prompt you and it will say, hey, do you want to you be able to use your Apple ID to unlock Screen Time in case you forget the Screen Time passcode? It's not obvious from the UI what you have to do here, because it's like, oh, it's making me enter my Apple ID. Isn't that just going to, because once a thief has your Apple ID with your passcode, can't they just disable the Screen Time thing that way? What you have to do is you have to hit cancel when it prompts you to do that. It seems like you're saying you're canceling the whole operation, but you're not. You're just canceling this part. When you hit cancel, it prompts you and says, are you sure you want to have a Screen Time passcode and you don't want to have a way to get around that Screen Time passcode with your Apple ID? Because if you forget the Screen Time passcode, it could be bad for you. So, like, don't, you know, write it down somewhere. Don't put it in an iCloud keychain where the thief can get it because they own your Apple ID. Put it somewhere else, right? And you just hit cancel on that, and it prompts you, and you have to put, like, skip or whatever. And so then you'll have a Screen Time passcode that is not in your iCloud keychain. Don't put it there. Don't put it in a secure note, because they can unlock that with your passcode. Don't put it in the notes app. Put it somewhere else. And it's only four digits, but it could save your butt.
Yeah, I did all this morning when I saw this show up in the show notes. I have tried to put fairly straightforward descriptions and of how you do this in the show notes. And so in the show notes that you guys can see, sorry, the one I was talking about earlier is the one only the three of us can see. So anyway, we have stuff in the show notes for you folks, and hopefully that will be helpful. I mean, again, you know, it's what is your threat threshold, right? Like, if you don't go to bars, if you're never around people, you know, then maybe you don't need to do all these mitigations. But I don't know. I'm not a bar going kind of fellow, but nevertheless, you know, I immediately returned to using an alphanumeric passcode. I had been using one for a couple of years, maybe even a few years. And then it was in the last year or two, maybe it was during the mask thing, like Marco was talking about. I really honestly don't remember, but at some point I went to a 6-digit passcode. Well, now I'm back in the alphanumeric, and then I did all these Screen Time protections as well. And then I'm not an iCloud keychain person. Again, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but I am a one password kind of person. So obviously that's what I'm using for all of my banking passwords and things like that. So I feel better protected now than I was before. But yeah, this is alarming, and it's tough, because what is Apple supposed to do? Like, there are instances where people forget their Apple ID passwords. And then what are they supposed to do at that point? From Apple's perspective, they have a device that has been logged, you know, you have logged into that device, so to speak, you know, you've unlocked the device. Why not let the person do that? You know, well, why shouldn't they let them change their own Apple ID? And obviously we just described why not, but it's a tough nut to crack. And I don't know what the right answer is.
Yeah. And if you have a Mac, by the way, like, basically the passcode to your Mac is the password to your Mac account. So you can still change your Apple ID password if you forget it from your Mac, because it'll prompt you for your Mac password. And I think you can do it from the web through various techniques as well. You have recovery codes. Like, there's lots of other ways around this. Even if you do this, this is just protecting your phone. So if someone shoulder surfs your Mac account password and it's an admin account, you're also kind of owned as well. That I feel like is... You know, a little, like, again, if you're in a coffee shop on your laptop, typing in your Mac's password, and then someone shoulder surfs that from you and takes off of your laptop, you have a similar problem, maybe a similar mitigation. But, you know, anyway, thieves suck. Be careful out there.
Yeah.
Also, I wanted to issue a small correction to what I said on the talk show. So I guess this is auto follow out.
oh, no.
So I, you know, we were talking about this, and I was saying, like, you know, it normally I feel like my bank app is fairly safe because I use Face ID and because I don't store the bank password in 1Password. And so I thought that was safe. But then I realized, oh, no, that's not safe, because if you have, your, if you have the phone's passcode, then you can just type that in instead of providing Face ID. Well, it turns out that's wrong sometimes. So that when you, you know, when the app developer is storing something in Keychain, in the, you know, using the Keychain APIs, we are able to set different security levels and flags on it to, for like, you know, what kind of, how much security it needs, what should certain behaviors be, you know, does it require certain things to be unlocked, what happens when the phone locks, you know, stuff like that. And apparently one of the modes that app developers can choose to use is you can require the biometric Face ID or Touch ID, but not offer a fallback to the PIN code. And also, if somebody changes the registered face or the fingerprints, to have those not work, you know, in the app. So that,
yeah, that's what my bank does, because every time I get a new phone, I realize I can't use any of my bank apps and no entering my password. Like, it does, there's no prompt for it. It's like, oh, Face ID is totally disabled. You got to log in the long, painful way by typing in a bunch of stuff and answering a bunch of questions. And then at the very end of that process, it says, oh, and by the way, now that you've cleared all these hurdles, do you want to use Face ID? And you say yes. Every time I get a new phone, I have to do that. And
yep, me
yeah,
too.
There is no passcode fallback.
And that, and in this case, that's a very good thing, because that means that if you go through these vulnerabilities, you know, if you, if someone steals your phone and knows your passcode, but doesn't know your bank password, and it's, and you didn't store it in iCloud Keychain, then this will prevent them from being able to get into an app like this if it's configured this way. And that's also why...
Joke's on them, because my bank account has such low transfer limits, they'll only be able to steal a very small amount of money before they get locked out of my account.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, like, and this is why at the end of that process, when you are telling your bank account, please use Face ID, this is why it then immediately scans your face. Because what it's saying is not trust any registered face on this phone. What it's saying is trust this face, and it scans it, and then it trusts only that face. And same thing for Touch ID if you have a Touch ID device. So that's very good to know. And so it's not the attack surface is not as bad as I initially assumed, but it's still pretty bad. And so definitely start thinking of your phone PIN with the same level of security that you would treat your Apple ID password with. If your phone PIN is less secure than your Apple ID password, really ask yourself if that's the right move for you going forward, and really consider making your phone PIN, you know, a nice password.
And I was thinking that Apple needs to have, because I was thinking about what would happen if I, you know, if this happened to my phone and they got it, you know, stolen from me, even if I had the screen time password under, right? Kind of like on the phone and on the watch, there's these various features where you hold down the side buttons and it goes into like emergency mode, or the watch will like call the police if you're in a car accident and you're not conscious, and what, you know, like all those things they have for like in case of emergency, here's how you initiate the it's emergency time procedure on the phone or the watch, right? But there is no such user-friendly procedure that is easy to find or know or do quickly under pressure for my Apple ID is about to be owned. Log me out of all devices, you know, lock everything down. Like, you know, us as tech nerds could eventually figure out the right things to do. But in the moment when you're panicking, it's not so easy. Like, where do I start? What do I go to? Should I go to the web interface? Should I open Safari? Should I, you know, go on my iPad? Should I go on my Mac? Should I call somebody who has access to, like, we kind of know what we'd want to do. Change all your passwords, lock everything out, go into all your things that says log me out of all devices. But do you know how to get to the log me out of all devices in your iCloud thing quickly? Or would you just go to iCloud.com and like log in and like frantically look for something, right? I feel like there should be a big red button, which is like, my phone has been stolen, like whatever Apple wants to call it, right? And no, find my iPhone is not that solution, because I don't care about where my iPhone is. I care about where, you know, access to, you know, the keys to the kingdom. Lock down all my iCloud Keychain stuff and don't allow anybody in if they don't know my Apple ID password. Because again, you haven't, like, your Apple ID has not been compromised in that they don't know your Apple ID password. You never typed that in anywhere. All you did was type 1234. That's what they shoulder surfed. So I would love the big red button that says lockdown and everything. From this point on, nobody can do anything without knowing my Apple ID password. If they know your Apple ID password, you're further screwed. But, you know, there's only so much you can do.
Well, the problem, though, is that you probably wouldn't have the time to take those actions. Because if you think about it, you're outside at the bar. These people have already shoulder surfed your password. So they grab your phone. They run around the corner or whatever. And or as they're running, they are going in and changing your Apple ID password. Meanwhile, you're saying to someone near you, oh, hey, can I use your phone right now? Yes. Hand it to me. Quick.
Why it has to be a big red button, because the big red button should be press this button. It should be something as easy as pressing the side buttons on your phone or like whatever. It should be really easy to do. And you should be able to do it on behalf of somebody else by typing in their Apple ID, because locking down your Apple ID should be non-destructive. Like, anyone could do it to you you know, accidentally or whatever, doesn't stop anything from happening. Just raises the bar that now your passcode is no longer sufficient to do all the things that it had the power to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that. But even still, like, even if the three of us are out and let's say somebody runs with my phone and we know each other, we're friendly. Even if I said you give me,
you're chasing them, you're chasing down all that running you've been doing.
Well, I don't run that much anymore. I do other workouts.
It's a foot race at that point. I feel don't let them escape.
But my point is just like, I wouldn't have the time. Seriously, I wouldn't have the time to grab your phone out of your hand or have you unlock it and hand it to me and do a whole login and so on and so forth.
You could do it on your watch if you had an Apple Watch on or if you had a Mac laptop that was logged in. Like, I'm not saying it's a foolproof solution, but I'm saying it is so difficult to even know where to begin now, even if you did have access to the thing. And as for the thieves immediately doing it, you've probably got a 60 seconds to 90 seconds before they get anything done.
Have you used Find My recently? And I know that you're not that necessarily advocating.
Maybe that's the thieves would be worried about turning off Find My and not worried about owning your Apple ID, because they don't want the whole thing is they don't want your photos. They want the phone to resell and they want to buy things with your money. Like, that's what they want. But what you can, you're taking advantage of the fact that the cares don't overlap as much. The things the thief wants, the things that you want to protect are actually different. You want to protect your Apple ID and your photos. He doesn't care anything about your Apple ID.
I would also like to
mostly doesn't
my
care
money.
About your photos. Yeah, I know, but your money, you're mostly going to get back, or at least some of it. But money is replaceable, and they're not going to be able, because of the limits on most of the banking system, it's not like they're going to be able to drain your life savings. Like, that only happens in the movies with rich people, right? They can't get that much, unless your life savings is $1,000, in which case you have other problems. But they're not going to get all your money. They're probably going to want to use credit cards, which are fraud protected, right? If they use your debit card and your Apple Cash, they'll probably get most of it. But even then, there are limits and the bank will eventually flag it. You know what I mean? Like, but your photos and your Apple ID, that's what you care about. Because in the aftermath of this, you say, well, all those pictures that you had in your Apple ID, you're never going to see them again. And by the way, you got to start over with a new Apple ID. And no, you can't transfer any of your purchases. And that, forget about the purchases or whatever, but the family photos, I feel like that is the most valuable thing on your device. And other than looking for naked pictures of you, thieves don't care about that.
I feel like there's a bunch of jokes here, but I'm going to let it go.
Wise move.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hi, Future Marco. I feel like we should move to Ask ATP at this point.
Just I think
making
so.
Sure. Okay. Sounds like a plan. Bye, Future Marco.
Hey.
All right. Let's do some Ask ATP. And Petar Petrovich writes, a few days ago, I saw you flexing on Mastodon about your symmetrical residential gigabit fiber connections. And since I'm in the process of renewing my contract with my local ISP, I wonder if it's worth it to pay extra for such a thing, or should I stick to the cheaper packages with lower speeds? What are some of your use cases that are worth the extra monthly cost? How often is your link fully saturated? This is a great question, and I strongly implore you to consider who it is answering this question, because I cannot fathom a more nerdy group to answer this question. And so your needs and our needs may not mesh, and that's okay. But for me, I absolutely think that almost anyone could really benefit from, half a gigabit to a gigabit downstream speeds. As a silly example, and I actually forgot that this was in the Ask ATP questions for this week, but I was downloading the Xcode beta, which actually I think is fixed a problem with my forthcoming app, which I'm really excited about, because something was woefully broken. And I guess it was broken internal to Apple stuff, because then Apple fixed it, which is great. But anyways,
Swift UI.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It was Swift UI, and you're exactly right. Well, anyways, so I was downloading the new Xcode beta, and I had tweeted, whatever you want to call it, that, oh, look at this. And according to iStat Menus, John's favorite app, I was downloading at 103 megabytes per second, not bits, excuse me, 108 megabytes per second. Now, I'm sure that's probably not exactly right, but it was probably close. And that is really freaking fast. So I don't get those speeds that often. I typically top out at like 50-ish megabytes a second if I'm downloading something somewhat large. But nevertheless, I thought it was extremely cool that I was grabbing this humongous Xcode download that quickly. So on the downstream side, basically anytime you're downloading anything big, or you want it to be here immediately. So I don't know, say if you're trying to play music from Apple Music or Spotify or something like that, having a really, really wide, so to speak, download pipe, I think that's convenient to almost everyone. What I don't think is as cut and dry is having an equally large upstream pipe. For me, I love having it because I'm a weirdo and I do weird stuff with my internet connection. Keep it PG. And by that, I mean, I have a VPN running out of the house. You know, I have WireGuard on my Raspberry Pi. I also, for redundancy, run Tailscale, former sponsor. And I, whenever I'm not at home, like whenever my MacBook or my devices are not at home and are on foreign, if you will, Wi-Fi, even Wi-Fi that I trust, like my parents, for example, I still automatically connect to the Raspberry Pi via WireGuard, because then it's like I haven't even left the house. And that means all of my internet traffic, including just regular web browsing, looking at Mastodon, et cetera, that's still coming and round tripping through my house. And if I had a really slow upstream speed, I would feel it even remotely. And that's leaving that aside, you know, I am a devout Plex user. I won't talk too much about it, but suffice to say, you can stream things from other Plex users in certain circumstances, which means if somebody wants to stream something from me, it's nice to have a large upstream pipe. Whenever I need to upload anything, like if I'm uploading the recording this evening, that goes faster. And it just basically, when you have a big, huge, you know, symmetric gigabit connection, you wait less for everything, which is great. Like, I enjoy waiting, not very much. And so when I don't have to wait as much, that makes me happy. So that's my two cents. I don't know. Let's start with Marco. What, did I get this right? Or do you disagree?
No, that's pretty much it. I mean, you know, when you hear internet speeds, keep in mind those are bits, not bytes. And so divide by 8. And so, like, you know, you were saying you got a little over 100 megabytes per second download. That's pretty close to the theoretical maximum, which is 125 megabytes for a gigabit connection. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so if you think, you know, the thing is, these days, I mean, look, when you have a faster and faster internet connection, you're not going to be downloading everything at that speed, because you are going to be dependent on the server that you are talking to and its ability to send things to you at that speed and through all the different things that are in between you and it. So many things will not be faster, but many things will, because increasingly in this world we are being delivered things from CDNs who will have things being served to you from fairly close by, relatively speaking. And so anything served by a CDN, like a very large, you know, Xcode download, you know, we're not serving that from California. We're, you know, that's being served to us from somewhere closer. Unless you are in California, in which case you are probably having it served from California. But, but for the rest of you, anyway. So, you know, there's a lot of things like that where, you know, anything served by a CDN that's close to you will usually go like maximum line speed that it can get to you. And that's going to be pretty significantly different when you're talking about a large multi-gig download. I mean, these days, everything is huge. Every bit, like every app on your phone, is hundreds of megs. When you watch streaming TV, you're streaming hundreds of megs to gigs for, like, to watch like one TV show. You know, you're streaming a movie that's probably multiple gigs throughout the stream. You know, just sitting down watching Netflix at night, like you don't even realize you're streaming gigs of data. And so, and if there's more people in your house, or if you're trying to do more than one thing at once, like right now we're recording a podcast. This is using nothing. This, you know, this is using, you know, hundreds of kilobytes per second, probably. But what the fat pipe means is that I don't need to tell the other people in my house while I'm podcasting, hey, don't download anything right now. You know, like, it's not at risk at all. Like, it's just rock solid. And that's the kind of benefit you get with very fast connections. Things are just so rock solid. You have so much headroom, as Casey was saying. Like, there's so much headroom in the transfer speed that even when you're not using all of that bandwidth to download something from a CDN that's really big, like, even when you're not using all that, you are still getting benefits in other ways besides just, you know, not being, like, you aren't constantly downloading 125 megabytes per second, but you are getting other benefits. Like, and on the upstream, like, one thing I notice is when I am uploading a podcast, which happens on a fairly regular basis, it's going to happen in about 14 hours. And when I'm uploading a podcast, I'm uploading it to a CDN. And so it goes faster. It's simple as that. Like, it doesn't go a gigabit, because the CDN is not that close, but I notice it goes faster than when I'm in Westchester, and there I only have 150 megabit connection, which is very fast. At least it was very fast when I got it installed, you know, 12 years ago. But you know, I notice the difference. Whenever I'm back there, I notice. When I go from a gigabit to 150, I notice. And it doesn't, it's not like going back to dial up or anything. It's still a very fast connection, but there are areas, certain things that I do notice. And it's, again, it's not like a huge deal, but having a faster connection is a noticeable luxury. And it's really nice to know that, you know, at any given time, it's really nice to know, like, if something is being slow, it's probably not your fault. It's, at least it isn't your internet connection. You know, there might be other things at play there. And I would also point out the utility of gigabit connections is highly dependent on being wired with Ethernet. While wireless standards,
that's true.
You know, all the new Wi-Fi standards, they always advertise these peak speeds that you can get that are either, you know, hundreds of megabits, or even some of them advertise capabilities of being above a gigabit. In practice, the real world speeds are almost never that high. You have to basically be on top of the router and have no interference from anything else nearby, and be under, you know, ideal atmospheric conditions. Like, there's so many variables to Wi-Fi, and so if you are expecting high performance out of Wi-Fi only devices, or, you know, devices that are usually connected via Wi-Fi, you might not see as much of a real world gain, and so maybe it might not be worth it to you. But for wired devices, that benefit is very much there. And also, just make sure that you have a pretty decent modern router that can also that has gigabit upstream port, and that has enough grunt CPU wise and memory wise to actually maintain, like, you know, all the NAT tables and all the buffers and everything to actually, you know, route and process that fast of a connection. And, you know, and if your ISP supports that connection, usually, worst case scenario, you can just use the router they give you, because usually they will give you one that can handle that kind of connection if they're selling that kind of connection. But, you know, if you're stuck on, like, some old, you know, WRT54G, you know, maybe this is the time to upgrade it. But yeah, so make sure your other stuff can handle it. But if you are wired and if you have a good router, you will notice differences.
I think the biggest sin in ISP things is sometimes related to technology, sometimes related to finance, sometimes both, the incredibly asymmetrical connections where they give you a decent download speed and then a total garbage upload speed. Not just garbage compared to the download, but just not good, period. Where, you know, you'll get, you know, 150 megabits down, 2 megabits up. And that's not acceptable. The cable is the worst in this regard. So I would argue strongly for symmetrical, because your download speed is probably going to be okay. And if your upload speed is the same as your download speed, that's a symmetrical connection. And that's good. And the main use case for that is when you do FaceTime with people or whatever video conferencing is, your upload speed determines how you look to them. I know, because I FaceTime with relatives who have a crap internet connection and their upload speed is terrible and they look bad. Because it will squeeze their video over their tiny crappy connection. It's like their Wi-Fi is bad, but, like, bottom line, even if they were wired in, their upload speed is like 1 or 2 megabits, and you can't get, like, a really good high res 4K image with sound in that size pipe. Apparently they look bad because their upload speed is bad. So that's one thing to think about. The reverse side of that is if you are watching Netflix and you have a really slow internet connection, really slow, right? Or if there's a problem with it, or your Wi-Fi is bad, like, Netflix will still work. The picture will just look worse. They use adaptive algorithms to say, if your bandwidth type is smaller, we will send you more heavily compressed, lower resolution video. If you want to get what you're paying for, especially if you're paying more for the stupid 4K Netflix, you know, however much that costs extra, you'll need an internet connection that can handle that. And to the point that both of you made, that can handle that even if you're in a household with a family and your kid is downloading a torrent of something and someone else is watching a different video. Like, you need to be able to accommodate not how much it will take for you to watch 4K Netflix, but for everyone in your family to be doing whatever it is that they're doing on the internet at the same time. That is still way below a gigabit, to be clear. You do not need a gigabit for that. But it does argue for not getting, like, that lowest speed, thinking, well, I'll just wait for downloads, it won't be that big a deal. It will actually impact your quality of life in the common areas people do, watching streaming video and doing FaceTime with people, because you will look worse to them and your video will look worse. So at least pass the minimum bar. And in terms of saturating a gigabit, a lot of it is impatience, like, oh, if you, I can afford to pay for it and I'm impatient. So yeah, downloads will go faster, but not as often as you would think. There is very few things that you can get that will fill a gigabit pipe. Apple from a good CDN will, Steam will, most peer-to-peer things will. I think Steam is actually peer-to-peer. But it's a short list. But and probably not on that list is one that people don't think about that I just had an encounter with recently. Game consoles. Most good modern game consoles will download something for you while you wait. But when a game is coming out, like the new expansion of Destiny just came out, they will not make it available for download until X number of hours before the release time. And if your internet connection is too slow to download it during that window, everyone else will be, well, let's face it, they'll be in the login queue. But anyway, let's pretend the login queue doesn't exist. Everyone else will be playing their fun new game and you're still waiting for your download to finish. While I was stuck in my room in COVID, my PS5 downloaded an 80 gigabyte Destiny 2 expansion.
Goodness.
Right? And I because I came down, I'm like, oh, the Destiny 2 expansion is coming out tomorrow. I better start my download. I turned on my PS5, which was in rest mode, and it was already there.
Nice.
Could that have happened over less than gigabit? Probably, but I wouldn't want to be waiting on the download to finish because of my slow connection. 80 gigabytes is big, and this stuff is distributed through a CDN, and it's granted, it's a crappy CDN, so it probably wouldn't saturate a gigabit, but no. Anyway, the reason we complain about waiting for Xcode to unzip itself on XIP itself is because for us with gigabit connections, that takes longer than the download.
Yeah.
That's part of that stupid complaint that we have. It's not that unzipping takes a long time, it's that our downloads are so fast. So I don't think you need a gigabit for almost anything, but boy, it's nice to have. I would just argue for sufficient bandwidth and symmetrical bandwidth. And how much is sufficient? You can do some back of the envelope math and say, okay, with four people in this family, if they're all watching 4K Netflix, we need 20 megabits down and 20 megabits up, or 15 or 5 or whatever, you know. The other thing about bandwidth is, especially if you have a decent ISP, and if you're offered symmetrical anything, your ISP is probably better than most. The cost difference between, you know, 5 megabits, 20 megabits, 50, 150, and a gigabit, they want you to pay for the more expensive one. It's not proportional. The 100 megabit service does not cost one-tenth the 1,000 megabit usually. And so they're trying to herd you up market to pay for the maximum price. So the 100 megabit will cost $20 a month, and the 1,000 will cost $50 a month. And that's a good deal in terms of price per bit. And then once you can get over that hurdle of $50 a month, if you can afford it and you're not, you know, taking money away from your grocery fund, it's a nice quality of life upgrade. But in the meantime, just look for symmetrical and don't assume you can get away with a really small connection in both directions just because I'm only ever going to watch Netflix, because you'll be surprised how much the things in your house are doing while you're watching Netflix.
Yep, yep.
I forgot. Online backups. Online backup service, but it told me it's going to take me 17 days to upload my Mac. Yeah, it would take slightly less time. And again, most online backup services will not use it a gigabit connection. But if your upload speed is garbage because you have cable and it's like 1 megabit up, it's going to take forever to do your first backup of your 2 terabyte Mac that you just got, right? Or whatever. So that really helps. And it's not, you know, you probably don't need, again, you don't need a gigabit, but 500 megabits, 200 megabits, so whatever your backup service is willing to take from you, it can really cut down on the pain of online backup. Because a lot of people say, I was going to get online backup, but then I tried for, went for a free trial and it told me my initial backup would take 30 days and I can't handle that, right? It, you know, if it takes 15 days, 7 days, that can really help. Again, even if it's not going to saturate your gigabit. So think about it.
Yep. Max Slaves writes, do you use tools like Aldente or Battery to manually limit the charging level on desktop MacBooks? So I want something like this in my life very, very badly. And when I saw this in our, you know, internal show notes, I went and I tried Battery, which I presume John linked. And I got to tell you, it did not work for me. Like, literally did not work. Not that's not the euphemism version of did not work. Like, it literally did not work. Maybe I was holding it wrong, I don't know. And uninstalling it was not really working exactly as I expected. It is all open source, so I don't think anything nefarious is going on here, but it didn't work for me. And then even if it had worked for me after I installed it, I noticed that there's an issue on GitHub saying, oh, if you clamshell your Mac, it doesn't work properly. Super. I did not try Aldente. I feel like there must be some like easier tool to do this, or even do this by hand on the command line. It looked like Battery was using SMC or something like that. But
does that coconut battery thing do this? I forget.
I don't know. I've never heard of that one. But But yeah, I want something like this because it is said, I can't attest whether this is true or not. It is said that, you know, you should keep your battery at about 80%, generally speaking, you know, and not charge over 80% unless you know you're really going to need it. We've talked in the past that there's a way, I should actually figure out where this is because I was just looking for this the other day and it's buried in the most unusual spot. So there's a way to tell macOS, hey, don't charge above 80 unless you think you really need to. So if you go into settings, not preferences, mind you, but settings.
I think this is on by default on new Macs, by the way.
It might be. Settings, yeah. Battery, and then, oh, this is so infuriating. So if you go into settings, follow along if you're in a position that you can. Settings, battery way on the left, about maybe two-thirds of the way down.
I don't have a battery item, Casey. What should I do?
You're the worst. All right, well, for those of us who can, on the right-hand pane, on the right-hand pane, you'll see the old battery, low power mode, only on battery is the way I have it set, whatever. Battery health, the chart, options. Well, clearly it's going to be in options, isn't it? So you click on options, put hard drives to sleep, hard disk to sleep impossible, wake for network access, optimize streaming video. Okay, that's not it. Well, where is it? Do you happen to know where it is, Marco?
Hold on, I'm hitting. Oh, I found it.
Tell me how much sense this makes.
Wait, hang on. I'm going to guess, but I'm not seeing this on my screen, obviously, because I don't have a battery. Is
hold
it
on.
Control
I can send you. No. I can send
it's
you
in
a
the
screenshot.
Battery thing.
Yeah, I'll send you a screenshot real quick. Give me 2 seconds.
You have to click something that's not
so
a button.
So first of all,
like
when I opened up the settings app and then I scrolled down and clicked battery, the right pane did not actually change to the contents of the battery pane for about three or 4 seconds.
Yeah.
And there was no beach ball, no spinner. Like it just was still showing the general tab. For like 3 or 4 seconds, just no feedback whatsoever. Great app settings, Pete, settings team. This is great.
Great work.
I'm so glad this shipped. You know, this totally was ready to ship to all your customers. Yeah, good job. Mm-hmm.
All right, so don't tell us where it is yet, Marco. Mm-hmm. John, can you figure out where it is on the screen?
The little eye on the battery health?
Yes, it is.
I know about the secret eyes. I've spent too much time in system settings. If you see a tiny little eye in a circle, that doesn't look like a button. And there surely is nothing important stuck under there. It's probably just information, a little eye, just info.
Exactly.
There's no settings under there.
How could there be a setting? It's only information.
If you use system settings on macOS Ventura, you quickly learn the stupid little eyes is where whatever setting you're looking for is hiding. And don't try to use search because 50% of the time I won't find it anyway.
Yeah. So if you click on the secret eye, I really like that. You click on the secret eye, you can see battery condition, maximum capacity. Oh, there's a toggle. Optimized battery charging. To reduce battery aging, your Mac learns from your daily charging routine so it can wait to finish charging past 80% until you need it for use on battery.
Can you search for battery condition now and see where the search sends you? Because I bet the search sends you to the screen you just put a screenshot of, not the one under the eye, because I don't think search can send you to this. I think search will just send you to this thing with the graph and say, look, I was helpful. See, I searched and I found it. You search for battery condition and I sent you to this page where the words battery condition do not appear.
As far as I can tell, it is not available in search anywhere. I've tried searching for optimized charging, battery charging. It's not.
Well, but what's interesting, though, is I typed in battery condition in search, and the first option is battery. The second option is battery health with a subtitle of battery, which is that's the secret eye that you want. But when you click on that line item, it just brings you to the battery.
Yeah, I don't. That's what I'm saying. I don't think the search can send you to those things that pop up modals. There's no direct sort of deep linking way to get to them. So not only are things poorly arranged in system settings, not only does search fail a lot of the time, but there are certain parts that search cannot reach because it cannot take you there. It like you can type it in, and even if it knew about it, it's like, well, I know about it, but as this happens to me all the time, I type search and it brings me to the results page. And I'm like, why did you bring me to this result page? Because I don't see what, and then you'd have to like scroll through the result page and find all the little eyes and click on them and find a pie symbol in the lower left corner and click on that. And it's madness.
It is bad. Anyway, so I don't use any of these. If somebody, I mean, maybe battery works for everyone but me, but if somebody has a reliable answer, especially if it's like, you know, open source, I'd love to see it. So please feel free to.
Now that we did all that searching, why is what's built into macOS insufficient? So that, like I said, I think this is the default now. If you go to Mac laptop, whether it's a default or not, if you can find the setting that we just dug for, you can tell it, hey, Mac, even when you're plugged into a power cable, don't charge to 100%. When you get to 80%, just stop there. And then there's a thing in the menu bar where you can say, hey, I'm about to leave, go to 100%. And for over the next 30 minutes, it'll bring you up to 100% and then you can leave. But I'm pretty sure that's the default. And I think that default, only charging to 80% unless you say otherwise, is all really I'd ever want personally, not that I use laptops. out of a laptop in terms of battery health. It's what all of our phones do when you plug them in the nightstand. They charge to 80% and then they wait like an hour before you wake up and charge the rest away or whatever. Your laptop, if it's plugged in all the time, it will never go to 100. It'll just stay at 80 unless you tell it,
no.
Hey, I want you to go to
100. Oh, no, it does not. Because Apple's algorithm or whatever, in order to figure out whether or not you need to go to 100, at least in my experience, is that it errors on the side of, oh, let's go all the way to 100, baby. It errors to that side. And so I really don't need to be above 80 almost ever. And in fact, I would vastly prefer if there was a way for me to say, just always stop at 80. And I will tell you when I need more, but I can't do that. And so right now, my battery is sitting at 100%. And I really, really wish it
That's
wasn't.
Weird. Yeah, I mean, I have
the same problem.
I have my laptop is always plugged in. It's one of the kids' laptops hanging here, and I never see it above 80. I mean, it's literally always plugged in, but it never goes above 80. I don't know. Maybe this is a bug. I can't tell if it's a feature or not, but I've always felt like this 80% feature is too aggressive, and it just literally, every time I look at the laptop, it's 80. It's always 80 because it's always plugged in.
Well, I wish I had that problem because I have the reverse where it is always 100, and I really wish it wasn't. What are you gonna do? So anyway, I guess John, you can't help us with.
I just rely on the built-in things. And before the built-in things, I just let it fry my batteries.
Delightful. How about you, Marco?
I've never used these apps before. I like John. I would just let my batteries slowly melt. Before this,
Well, you own laptops long enough for the batteries
exactly
to go
what
bad.
I was gonna say. That's exactly what I was gonna say.
Just buy a new laptop every 6 months.
Drop it in the shredder, get a new one.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. All right, and friend of the show, Brian Hamilton writes, Instagram ads for scammy mobile games are annoying, but despite the horrendous UI, predatory in-app purchases, and oddly creepy character design, some of the puzzles look kind of fun. Drawing a shape to save the dog or dropping water onto lava to clear a level could be fun if the apps were well-designed and the monetization made sense. Why aren't good iOS game devs making this brand of time-wasting Instagram-friendly game? I don't really know, but I would guess because there's money
in
it.
There's so many answers to this. Okay, so the first one is, advertisements are meant to be enticing, kind of like we're on a movie or TV show. They'll show you what they think is the best or most enticing part of that movie or TV show to get you to want to see it. Same thing with games. They will show you something that looks like it's fun, perhaps the most fun part of the thing. Maybe the advertisement isn't even representative of the actual gameplay. You don't know. It's an ad. So that's answer number one. Answer number two. The companies that can afford to pay designers who know how to make fun things are the ones that are fleecing everybody with creepy app purchases, right?
That's the one. That's the answer.
That's where all the money is being. That's how they can afford to make those enticing ads. It doesn't mean the games are necessarily fun because they are junked up with, mechanics that are not friendly to people and these things that psychologically find ways to extract money from you, right? So it doesn't necessarily mean the games are fun, but it means that they had the potential to be fun if all that cruft couldn't be removed because those companies can hire all the game designers. And by the way, that itself is a skill. Knowing how to extract the max amount of money from people is a thing that people get good at, and they get good at it because they are highly motivated to get good at it because there's a lot of money to be extracted and it is an efficient machine for extracting money. And so the people who are good at it are highly paid, and it's a virtuous cycle, not from our perspective, but from theirs, where lots of people become very good at this and get paid a lot to do it. And so those skills get built up. I think there are fun games that don't do this, but you don't see them with enticing ads on Instagram because the only people who do those type of things are the people whose whatever it is, I forget the acronym. What is it, like the cost per user that they acquire, or the amount of money they expect to make from a person who downloads their game has to be high enough to make up for the amount it costs them to show that ad to those people. And with these type of games, I think like we have an amazingly addictive mechanic. Once we are hooks into you, on average, we will extract X number of dollars from you over the next 6 months, which means most people will get $0 from, but five people will get $1,000 from. Those are our whales. And so it averages out. And so that's why we can have these enticing Instagram ads. And that's why we can pay these game designers to make it an ostensibly fun game that really is just a secret puzzle box to extract money from you. My main suggestion would be don't believe everything you see in an ad. The games aren't actually that fun. And my second suggestion is that's where the money is. So that's sad.
And it's, it's a double-edged sword. Like, so not only are the ads that you're seeing only the ones who could bid up those prices, and if you've never bought app install ads, you might have a different view of how much they cost than what they actually cost. They're really expensive. like a typical installation from an app install ad, depending on it depends heavily on the category that you're in, but usually you're above a dollar. Sometimes you can even be multiple dollars per installation, depending on the category and the competition and everything. But not every installation even results in somebody ever running the app. Not every person who runs the app will ever run it more than once. And so you have to, once you start like multiplying out, all right, well, if only so many of these installs are actually real and actually result in somebody opening the app ever, and then actually result in that person ever coming back in the future, you end up getting into like many dollars per active user of the app. And so you have to have a very, very high average user value to make that worth it, to make you not just lose money constantly. Consequently, also, if you can make that profitable, you have all the incentive in the world to spend infinite money on customer acquisition by buying more ads. Because if you have a balance there where you are making money, where you are spending less per customer than you are bringing in, then there's no reason for you to stop buying ads. You will buy as many ads as you can buy at those prices. Until your money runs out, which if you're doing it right, it won't. So because these ads are so expensive and because so many people are bidding on them who have these money-making schemes, that's all you're going to see. You're only going to see the people who have these big budgets so that they can spend more on ads, outbid other players or other competitors, and still make a profit. So you're only going to see the games that are really fleecing people for money. If you are a, quote, good developer and you're making a game that's a little more traditional and a little more, respectful of people and not trying to just fleece them and play psychological tricks to, get all their money. Like, if you're trying to do things like, quote, the right way, it's really hard for you to find a market for your game because all of the ads are being bought and bid up by those other companies who are doing things the other way. So it's very hard to like get noticed in the iOS game scene and to succeed making good, respectful apps. Because as much as we want that to not be the case, and as much as we want, as much as Apple always talks about how great the App Store is for all these small businesses and everything, the discoverability is so great in the App Store, the value of all that has gone way down over time as there's just been more and more and more competition. So you're not going to be found in the App Store very easily if you don't spend money. And if you're a game developer, who you're spending money against is just so ridiculously hard to compete with, unless you are also doing the same tricks they're doing to get super high valuations per active user. And so if you're making games like the quote good way, you just can't compete, and you won't ever find an audience for your games in all likelihood. And so people who are trying to do things that way typically go elsewhere or give up. Or go to the dark side.
That's why game consoles are so refreshing these days. Sort of the AAA game market, which is smaller than the mobile game market in terms of dollars. But the reason we don't call those ones making all the money AAA is because we realize they're just like very often money extraction devices and less an attempt to make the best game you can make. And in the world of console and PC, among the smaller market of people who shop there, the exploitive mechanics are looked down upon. Like, for like Destiny, the game that I play, lots of other sort of multiplayer online games, even ones with subscriptions or whatever, the thing that customers hate the most is what, they derisively call pay to win, where if I pay you more money, you'll give me a more powerful sword that I can beat people up with. And users will not accept that within the top tier AAA things. They will only pay for, and they'll pay a lot for, cosmetics, things that don't affect gameplay, because they consider it unfair for someone with money to be able to play to advance in the game, like to get better items, to get more in-game money. Like, they don't accept that as, any money that can be used to make you more powerful in the game. It's like if you had a poker game and you could pay to get like a better hand or something. Like, nobody likes that, right? And they'll gladly play for cosmetics forever, but the cosmetics don't affect gameplay. And if the cosmetics even remotely affect the gameplay, they will complain. I think I've talked about this before. There was a Destiny cosmetic that made the barrel of your gun like an inch or two longer. It was a totally different skin for your gun, but the point is the barrel was a little bit longer in game, like 2 or 3 in-game inches, right? Person's holding a gun, the barrel's a little bit longer. that affected the range of the weapon by 2 or 3 inches, and people were in an uproar about it because the range was measured from the front of the model, right?
Oh my God.
Oh my
and,
word.
And they were in uproar. They're like, it's pay to win. It's pay to win. That those antibodies do not exist in mobile gaming. They're all pay to win. They'll like, oh, get an extra life, get a thing where if you die, you'll resurrect yourself, buy more gem. Like, they're all pay to win. Now, granted, most of them are multiplayer or whatever, but that's how different these markets are. The quote unquote AAA market, where you got to pay $70 for a game plus, you know, $80 for the fancy version, and you pay that every year, or you pay $15 a month to play World of Warcraft or whatever. Those markets filled with people who play those games will not tolerate garbage mechanics like that. They're like, that shook out of that market. People tried all sorts of things and they said, we do not want to play a game where other people with money can play to get a bigger sword to beat me up with. Just sell us horse armor. And so that has been the way forward in AAA, whereas in mobile, it is very different. So it makes me, you know, strangely comforted to continue to pay, you know, again, at least $100 a year, probably more. And I don't really buy that many cosmetics for this game with millions of players that cost millions upon millions of dollars to make, that I think respects me as a game, as a gamer, way more than, you know, the free to play application with a bunch of gems or pouring water on lava that I can get on my phone.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace and Collide. And thank you to our members who support us directly. You can join at atp.fm/join. And we will talk to you next week.
So, Marco, something interesting is going on at your house, I take it.
So, do either of you, I mean, John, your kids are a little older now, obviously, but Casey, I'm curious, do you or John, did you ever impose time limits on your children's iPads for screen time or for YouTube?
I did, even though I very quickly recognized the futility of it, which is, I'm sure, what you'll describe.
Casey?
Yeah, so, I mean, remember that Declan is 8, he's in second grade, Michaela is in her last year preschool, she'll be in kindergarten next year, she's freshly 5. The kids have my old iPad Pro, they had an older iPad before that, and Declan has like an iPhone 10 that does not have service, it's a Wi-Fi, it's effectively an iPod Touch, mm-hmm. And yeah, I literally have screen time, as in the Apple stuff that we were talking about earlier in the show. I have that enabled for his iPhone, and he seems to respect that. He isn't really into YouTube that much these days, not in the way that, like, you know, yeah, I think it will be soon. Oh, no, I don't argue that this time will come, but it hasn't come yet. Although I did find it interesting that he was trying to draw some Pokemon recently, and he turned to YouTube videos to instruct him on how to do that, which I was actually kind of proud of him because
it begins.
I'm not sitting on any sort of high horse. I am not trying to be smug. If I am coming across that way, that's not on purpose. I know my time is coming. But all of this is to say, at this point, you know, we don't let them use the devices but for very long each day. And it's at typically pretty well-defined times. And that's just the way it's always been. So they understand that. And we haven't really restricted that much because they're just not aware yet of what there is that they could be doing. You know, even, and I'm not even talking about naughty things, but like, I don't think Declan has really gotten to the point that he thought to himself, well, I'm just going to cruise YouTube and watch random junk. And that time is coming probably sooner than I'm comfortable with, but we're not at that point yet. So he hasn't gotten to the point of like trying to do nefarious stuff to get around any sort of limits or anything like that. I take it though, because Adam, you said, is in fifth grade. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. He's almost 11. You know,
he is at that point now, huh?
Yeah. So, and with the huge disclaimer up front here, parenting stuff is always fraught. Everybody has different opinions of what is an appropriate amount of screen time and screen permission for children. And if your opinion is different than what I do, that's fine. You do what you want to do, and I'm going to do what we think is right for our family. You do what's right for your family. Okay. So, our kid, he's almost 11. He has his own iPad. He's allowed mostly unmonitored YouTube watching, but within limits. Because, you know, look, you know your kid. And we've expressed to our kid numerous times to the point where he's tired of hearing about it. You know, the difference between, like, you know, good stuff and bad stuff he can see online, and what's appropriate for anybody, you know, and what's appropriate for children versus not appropriate for children. And we've never had any reason to not trust him to to self-regulate that. You know, whenever we do watch something that he's watching with him, or at least we might overhear it from, like, you know, across the room if he's, like, somewhere where we can't see it, it's always been pretty safe stuff. And so we don't feel the need to be very aggressive about our YouTube filtering. We do limit the amount of time, though. We limit the overall iPad time, again, using the built-in screen time feature. We limit the iPad to only certain hours of the day so that he can't, like, you know, wake up at 2 in the morning and just play with his iPad all night. You know, so that's obviously something you don't want to encourage. So we have certain hour bounds that you can't use the iPad between, you know, X and Y. And also, YouTube in particular is the only remaining thing that we actually have a limit of. I believe it's 1 hour a day that's currently set to. And that's maybe the best reason in the world, but this is the reason we have that I felt like watching YouTube was very passive of an activity, and I would rather he play a video game where he's doing something than just watch YouTube for hours and hours and hours. I also didn't feel like there was enough good, high-quality content for him to watch on YouTube to consume many hours a day. And there are times, like weekends, where sometimes, you know, if it's like a rainy weekend day, he might be on his iPad for many hours that day. And so we didn't want to, you know, it was important to me to limit YouTube to help promote more active or more creative activities like games or drawing or whatever.
Do you ever think about what it'd be like when you were a kid if your parents tried to limit you to 1 hour of TV a day? And I'm speaking as someone whose parents did try to do that. And boy, it was like there was no technology to do that. But I'm saying parenting wise, it seemed like really kind of, you know, swimming upstream. All of my parents' draconian TV limits, they lasted for a little while, but eventually they gave in because kids whine just too much.
I mean, I think what it comes down to, what it came down to back then is, like, there was really not a good way for our parents to easily limit that. As you said, like, you know, here we can do it pretty easily with screen time. It's
can we?
So.
Oh, no.
Now, screen time, it has a bunch of, you know, weird little gaps. As far as I know, there's not many, like, totally egregious ones. Oh, there is one that I wish they would have an option to turn off. There is, as far as I know, there isn't one. There is this concept of one more minute. And if you're past your time limit on an app or on the iPad in general, you can, when if you try to launch an app, it'll show this big white, you know, screen time, you know, you're out of time screen. And there's a button at the bottom to, like, you know, enter the screen time passcode if you want to extend, or you can ask for more time, which sends your parents a notification and you can approve it remotely. You know, and you can say, you know, 15 minutes or an hour or whatever. But there's also this button that says one more minute. And I think the way it works is every limit you have exceeded, you're allowed to hit the one more minute button to get one more minute of that particular app for that interval. So what this means, and what actually has happened on a regular basis, is suppose we are trying to watch a movie, you know, me and Tiff, we're trying to watch a movie right after, and, you know, we want to start, like, right after he goes to bed. Sometimes, in order to facilitate this, we will offer him 15 minutes of YouTube time on his iPad in bed, and then we'll go, you know, pick it up at that, you know, after that point, and usually he'll be asleep. But if we, like, don't set a timer, and he might have the, and but we think, okay, well, he's past the limit, it'll only be 15 minutes. No. The one more minute hack works individually with every app. And he might have, like, 30 apps or more. So what he'll do is he'll do the one more minute on, you know, YouTube or whatever first. And then when that runs out, he'll go do 1 minute of something else. Then when that runs out, he'll go do 1 minute of something else. And he'll go through
all my words.
And so you can easily have, like, a half hour of extended iPad time beyond what your parents thought you were able to do because you just keep hitting 1 more minute. So that's one issue. But anyway, so as far as I know, I don't think there's any other, like, giant holes. Like, if you say YouTube, you know.
Oh, no, there is.
Please don't tell him. But anyway, so
he'll find them on YouTube. Don't worry.
I know. So the other day, he's a very honest kid. You know, he doesn't like, you know, lie and hide stuff. So the other day he said, "I found a way around my YouTube time limit. It doesn't work very well, and it's slow. Do you want me to tell you about it?" Now, what would you say if your kid says, first of all, like, you know, the honesty of this kid is awesome. You know, like, he doesn't just sneak around and do it. He's so excited that he found a way around it that he wants to share the information.
That is pretty funny.
We're obviously, a nerd family here. Everything's open source, right? But what would you do if your kid asks, I found a way
unquestionably,
around this, do you want me to tell you about it?
Yeah, unquestionably, yes, I would like you to tell me. But first and more importantly, I really, really, really appreciate the fact that you were honest about it and you're not hiding this from me. You know, that's really, really important.
You're putting that idea into his head. You mean I could have hidden it?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, well, see, this is why parenting is hard. But I mean, I think that I would say yes, please. But, you know, it's really important to me that you understand that I appreciate the fact that you were honest about it.
So I, of course, had to ask him a clarifying question. Because I said, I'm like, all right, well, hold on a second. If you're using a way around the limit, there's two things you could be doing here, one of which is bad. I don't want you going around limits in order to see something you shouldn't be seeing. That's bad. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But if you're cheating the system to just get more time, that's fine. And I told him, I said, no, don't tell me. Because I'm like, my job as your parent is to try to impose reasonable limits. And your job as a tech-savvy kid is to try to find ways around them. And I said, and if I figure out what you're doing and I close the loophole, then that's too bad for you. But I'm like, I actually don't want to know yet. And so, okay. And that was a few weeks ago. So eventually he's like, I see him watching, meanwhile I was like, what's he doing? Like, I took off Safari, figuring like if there's some website that's like rehosting YouTube videos on their own domain, maybe he's watching it, because normally, you know, the youtube.com domain is protected via the associated app domains thing, so that's protected already. And I'm like, and web views are protected, and I'm like, okay, so what could he possibly be doing? So we took Safari off, and I was like trying to figure out, like, what's he doing? How's he getting around this? You know, some other app maybe? Like, is he watching stuff? Like, somehow, like, is Netflix on his iPad? I don't even know. I don't think so. You know, like, I was trying to figure out what this was. And then the other day, I see him watching a video, and he has this big smile on his face. He's looking at me. He's like, do you want to know how I'm doing it? So I will tell you, it is not anything to do with watching on a different domain or watching in Safari or watching in a web view. What's your guess?
So I had heard, I think a couple of years ago now, that kids would iMessage each other and they would use the little postage stamp player within iMessage, you know, the rich preview, if you will, in order to watch the video there, which sounds freaking terrible, but you know,
that's
if you're a kid,
amazing.
Don't really care.
Yeah, that was the main exploit. Was you here's the reason it was a great exploit is because for kids who had phones, very often and sensibly, the parents would make iMessage one of the apps that's enabled 24 hours in case your kid needs to text you, and you can lock it down to say, hey, they can only text family members, but they would text themselves. And from within because they're in the family, and from within the message they texted themselves,
yeah, there it is. Okay.
you could get actually a full size player eventually. I think they might have closed that one, but that was one of the most popular ones, was texting yourself links to YouTube videos you wanted to see after everything locked down. You could do that even after downtime, lock down everything, like the whole, like, everything on the phone is off except for whitelisted rewind. Everything on the phone is off except for a specifically set allow list of people that you can send messages to. And that is limited to only your family. Boy, this phone is so locked down. I'm sure there's no way they can get. No, they would just message themselves because they're part of the family.
That's awesome.
The second one that the chat room's talking about is tons of very often not particularly great applications have ways for you to get to YouTube from within the application. Someone in the chat room said it was a periodic table application. Like a chemistry class that you could get to YouTube from within. You're like, oh yeah, you can use the periodic table application as much as you want. No time limits on that. And then you can get to YouTube from that. And lots of apps had a way to do that basically by having, you know, an embedded web view and that is using an older technology that's not stopped by screen time. That was the other common exploit, is you can stop the YouTube app and you can stop the YouTube domain in Safari, but you don't know what other apps are doing, especially older cruddy education apps that may be part of their school. The word gets around, hey, if you in the school's periodic table app, you can watch YouTube forever.
That's also not what he was doing.
All right, so hold
on. Don't tell them about those because they're probably still open. Like, that's the thing that I learned when I was learning about all these things. These are exploits. You can't do anything about them as a parent, like technologically speaking. And Apple's probably not going to close them because they're not that big a deal. Like, that's kind of my meta position on this entire thing is technology can help you do stuff like this. But in the end, enforcement of parental limits is exactly the same as it has ever been, which is it's a fantasy, not a fantasy. It's a sort of a contract between true people. And yes, there are tools that can help with it, like clocks and doors and houses and, you know, screen time limits. But in the end, it is a sort of a relationship negotiation between parent and child. And it doesn't really matter how many tools are in the mix there. And so rather than framing it as a technological chicken egg race, which is a fun thing to do or whatever, like in the end, the actual limits you're dealing with are the same limits you say, like, you know, a curfew. Curfew doesn't cause a giant metal claw to come and grab your kid at 11:30 p.m. and bring them back to your house. Curfew is just a thing that you tell your kid, and no technology is going to change whether they, you know, come in on their curfew or not. You can see where their location is and find my friends or whatever. That does not make them come home any faster. What makes them come home is the relationship of trust you've hopefully built with your kid and an agreement that 11:30 p.m. is a reasonable time when we all agree that that's when you're going to come home.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what Adam could be using to do this.
Yeah, so I remember how he described it was, it doesn't work very well and it's slow.
He needs to get better exploits.
So I was thinking,
the ones I just described didn't have that problem.
I know. I was thinking, like, it's slow. Is he, like, somehow transcoding the video?
Yeah, I was
going to
say,
has
he got, like, ISH and he's at his YouTube
demo?
Yeah,
is he, like, running shortcuts to, like, pull the video with a shortcut and then convert? How is he
doing share play from a different machine?
Yeah, right.
And that would probably also work, by the way, Adam.
Yeah, don't tell him. Good thing he doesn't listen.
I don't know. I don't know what he was doing.
So, this is so adorable. He was screen recording them as they play, making his own copies to save in his photo roll.
So he was transcoding them.
And he says, then I just watch them again after I haven't seen it in like a month, so I forget what happens.
Oh, my word.
This is an efficient use of resources. I mean, don't you pay for the YouTube Premium where he can just download them in the YouTube app?
I don't know if he knows he can.
I mean,
that
might be harder to get them out of the YouTube app. But screen recording, like that's given that that's a tool that kids, surprisingly, a number of kids know about. Like, I can't remember if I have ever screen recorded my iOS device. But once I think word gets around among kids that this is a thing that you can do for a variety of reasons, and that becomes a tool they use to do everything. Like, for example, my daughter does not know about saving images. Anytime she sees an image that she wants on her screen on her iPhone, she screenshots it. And I keep telling her that's not full resolution, but she doesn't care. She doesn't care. It's got all the Chrome. It's got your status bar. She doesn't care. I'm like, you know, you can just hold your finger on it and hit save image. It's like, nope, screenshot. So I feel like screen recording YouTube is right in that same alley of like, hey, I know about screenshots. I know about screen recording. And if there's something that I see on my screen that I want, if it's stationary, screenshot. And if it's not stationary, screen capture or screen recording.
That's bananas.
So, home taping is ruining YouTube.
Mm-hmm. That's very clever. I have to give him credit. That is very, very clever.
Yeah,
Not fast, but very clever.
And it's such like the perfect kid solution to the problem. It's like, it's something that, you know, I was thinking way too technically and way too sophisticated.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like, no, this is actually an ingenious thing that I would never have thought to look for this, or I would never have considered this possibility because like I have adult brain. I'm thinking of like adult ways to do it that are totally different, you know? And he's like, no, you can just do this. And then I just watch it again later.
It's like a VCR for your whole iPad. Anything you see on your screen, you can just record it.
Live streams.
And the thing is, like, I don't know how many resources it's taking. Obviously, he's got like hand-me-down iPads that probably have lots of storage in them. But then, in terms of it being slow, it's like, is the frame rate the same? It's recompressing it. It's like this. He's getting
iCloud photo library. He's on the family iCloud.
He's on the family plan. Slowly filling. It's like, it seems like Adam's using a lot of data lately. Yeah. What are all these things?
Adam's photo library is a terabyte? What?
What?
And then it's not like, you just see if he's like naming them, like putting metadata on them, or is it just a question of you look at the thumbnails and find, because the thumbnails won't, I guess that YouTube, the practice is putting text in the thumbnail. So I guess you probably don't need anything except for just to be able to see the, you know, the little video thumbnail.
Well, and also, and like, I don't, like, I thought, you know, after he told me he was so proud, and I'm so proud of him for figuring that out. And I'm like, I don't think I have a problem with that. I talked to Tiff. I'm like, I think that's okay, because he's just making better use of the YouTube time he already has. He's just like, you know, he's not getting more new video time. So I'm like, I don't think this is actually even a problem that I need to do anything about. Like, I'm just going to let him keep doing it.
And obviously YouTube, and on the topic of YouTube time limits, YouTube is obviously way more scary than television was when we were kids. But it is very analogous in that there is actually tons of value to be had on television or on YouTube, just as there was on TV. There's also way, way more garbage and scary things as well. And that's what comes down to a question of your kid. It's like, well, I'd rather have him doing something creative like playing a game. But what if he was watching a video learning how to do math, which obviously is a ridiculously fantasy scenario, like, oh, my kid is going to choose to watch videos about math. You'd be surprised what kids get up to. I am always surprised when my kids tell me, hey, I learned about X, Y, and Z because of a video I watched. Now, granted, it was between 100 other videos that are just junk food for your brain and hopefully not a bunch of Nazis preaching to them, right? So it's scary, and I'm not saying don't monitor, and I'm not saying, like, don't, you know, be careful about it, but there is tons of value to be had. Way more. I had to watch PBS, and there was, like, three shows that I liked, and they were on, like, once a week, and if it was a crappy episode of Frontline, I was just going to skip it. YouTube, educational YouTube,
both ways in the snow.
Yeah, right, educational, right? YouTube has so. I still watch them. I watch, you know, when I went down the SR-71 rabbit hole, and I'm watching all those real engineering videos where the Irish guy tells me about fusion and stuff. Like, there's so much. I would have killed for this as a kid, right? And, you know, they're a varying quality, but a lot of them are entertaining and engaging to kids. That's why you get kids who are like, oh, yeah, no, I know all about the War of 1812 because I saw an animated YouTube video about it. Like, you voluntarily watch an hour and a half video on the War of 1812. It's like, yeah, it had stick figures and it was funny, right? That does happen.
Yeah,
and
that's so part of what he's watching.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, like, I do feel like 1 hour of YouTube is probably insufficient. And also, I would say mindlessly playing an infinite runner or like Plants vs. Zombies is less stimulating than watching the video about the War of 1812, but better than watching the video about, you know, becoming a Nazi or white supremacist or whatever, right? So it's dangerous, but I feel like YouTube is basically television for these kids. And it is a television that has higher highs, lower lows, obviously, but also higher highs than our TV did. Like, we just have to watch reruns of Happy Days, which was not intellectually stimulating.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, you know, when I was a kid, like, when I was watching TV, I was mostly watching, like, you know, Saturday morning cartoons, you know, a lot of, like, you know, Ninja Turtles and, you know, Animaniacs and that kind of stuff.
Did you ever watch the Computer Chronicles?
I don't know how much value that had.
Did either one of you watch the Computer Chronicles? Because I think that's a great example.
No,
I
think I did.
Or Motor Week. Casey must have watched that, right?
I still watch it. Are you kidding?
There you go.
Watch
right. So here's two shows. They were obscure. They were on PBS stations, but it was like, do you mean there's something on TV about computers? You bet your butt I would watch Computer Chronicles. I would record Computer Chronicles on my VCR by programming it to record if I wasn't going to be home for it, because it was literally the only time there would ever be anything on television that was about a thing that I was interested in, computers. YouTube has everything anyone is interested in. You're interested in model trains. You're interested in doing makeups. You're interested in building your own canoe out of whatever you're interested in. It is on YouTube. It is an amazing cornucopia of stuff. And kids are curious about things and they have their own interests and they can find things about that on YouTube. And I feel like allowing kids an age appropriate amount of access to that, like, I think is one of the better things that you can you know, facilitate your children to discover. You know, if they're not finding the good content, help them find it. If they're wasting their time watching things that you think aren't useful, give them the time that they need to do that, to just be kids the same way we watch garbage stuff or whatever. But if you're viewing YouTube as universal evil, I think that's the wrong way to look at it. TikTok, maybe jury style, but even on TikTok, there'll be some person who's up on screen giving you a musical rant about the War of 1812. Like, it could happen, but I think TikTok is a little bit more garbagey. And by the way, kids discovering YouTube, the next much worse stage is them discovering TikTok. So watch for that.
Fair enough. Titles.
Cool. We got a lot of titles this time. A lot of good.
Holy sh!
Well, Marco's on TikTok. He knows all about it.
Yeah, and I get a lot of information on TikTok, and some of it's even true.
Mm, yeah, sometimes.
The funnest of fun colors. I don't want to encourage that.
I like his Suba fits in the frunk. I like
that is
Anti
a fairly
Fireplace
ATP title.
Lobby.
Anti Fireplace Lobby is very.
I really like We're Just a Pump. That's just, it's so weird.
That is pretty, pretty good.
I think the better sousaphone title is probably Picturing a Sousaphone. That's better, I think. I like Trust This Face. Yeah, the anti-fireplace lobby is pretty strong.
Yeah, I do. I think that might
fireplace
be
fireplace haters, man. Just get rid of your fireplace.
Between
just
fireplace,
get rid of it.
Tuba Frunk, and probably Picturing a Sousaphone. I think those are my favorites.
Of those,
very good.
Of those, I like Anti-Fireplace Lobby, and I like We're Just a Pump. I might even like the Pump one more, but it is real close.
I think Fireplace Lobby is probably the better title of those two, but I do like them both.
John, thoughts?
Is there just one Pump one? We're Just a Pump?
I think so. I mean, there might have been some other.
I like Fireplace over that, but I was looking for it. Let me just scroll through this again.
Yeah, it's a big list.
This Is the Room is a fairly ATP title as well, and it does describe at least part of what we talked about.
Just sell us horse armor. And they do. So much horse armor.
There's In-Game Inches was good. Like, there's so many good ones this week. Not a Fun Blue is also pretty good. Like, it just there's so much. Trust This Face. That out of context, that's amazing.
What was that from?
I was describing like when you
trust
set a face ID
face.
With your bank app. It trusts yeah, this
yeah.
face.
Oh, yes,
not
yes,
any
yes,
face.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, that's
I mean I guess Fireplace.
Yeah, I think it's the best.
Overall. Alrighty, going in.
Cool.
It's Fireplace all one word? Capital F or lowercase F?
I think capital F, but in one word.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Agree it. Look it up, and I've looked it up, and it's one word. Just double checking. So easy to look things up. I talk about this in Rectif. Takes 2 seconds. Just look it up.
Mm-hmm.
Kids who don't want to listen to me, look it up. I don't want to look it up. I just know. The amount of time you debated me, you could have looked it up.
I just knew I was right. Marco, what are you using for markdown parsing on the administrative side of the website?
PHP Markdown Extra.
Can
what
you?
Is what I use for everything I've ever done markdown for server side, including all of Tumblr and all of where does Overcast use it? Oh, yeah, I use it for like my static pages in Overcast, like the feedback mm-hmm. pages, the privacy policy, all that stuff.
Can you update it? Is that a thing?
Because
I really want a double tilde on either side of a word to strike through or line through.
Oh yeah, you're
whatever.
A strike through person. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And I don't know if it's official markdown, but. Or I don't know if it's common
it's
mark
ancient.
Not to start.
It's this library is from before that was a thing. Like I've every like 5 years, I have to go edit something in this library because there's some new PHP warning of some deprecated usage that it's using. So I have to go like, nice. You know, add a keyword somewhere or, you know, remove a double dollar sign or something, you know, but it's. Yeah.
Well, add for me a double tilde, please.
I'm in the show notes because I want to fix this passcode thing because it is actually confusing. Did either one of you do this?
Which,
with the screen
which
time
this.
Thing? I did it during the show, yeah.
Yeah, I did it when I was taking those notes in the show notes.
All right, so the tricky part that I talked about on the show that I think should be in the notes. Well, first I'm changing it from like content and privacy restrictions account changes. You said like turn off what you want. No, it's just an on-off toggle. So you have to just pick don't allow. So
No, it's not. No, it's not. There's two. Hold on. Now I got to go back into it. Where is this?
Time, content privacy account changes.
Time? Can't
it's not the same as right. Yeah, hold allow on, and don't allow are literally the only choices.
No, content privacy restrictions.
What,
I'm now
save.
Now I'm just
late.
Looking at a big black screen.
Marcus thing is uploading to CDNs.
There we go. All right, hold on. Okay, so content and privacy restrictions. You turn on the toggle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you scroll all the way to the bottom. Allow changes, passcode changes, account changes, cellular data changes, reduce loud sounds, driving focus.
Yeah, account changes is the one that you go to. It's the only one that
yeah,
we care
that's
about.
That's the one that we're looking
account
at.
Account changes. So tap on account changes, and the only two choices are allow and don't.
Yeah, okay. So you don't consider passcode changes important?
No. Because you have to enter the old passcode. Like
yeah, they know it.
They shoulder surfed it from you.
Right, but that's what I'm saying.
They can't change the screen time password without knowing the screen time password, so don't worry about that. That's talking about your phone passcode.
Right, that's what I'm saying. This would disallow your phone passcode from being changed. Now, does that really matter? I don't know. But if you get your phone back, at least you know it's still the same passcode. I don't know. I think I stand by it, but you do.
Well, anyway, I changed it. But the main thing, the main hang up is the thing I put in the Slack channel. The confusing part is it will prompt you for your Apple ID. And
that
you have
did confuse
to not,
me earlier. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you have to not do that. So I wanted to put something in the notes that was like, when it asks you for your Apple ID, hit cancel. Even though it seems like you're canceling the thing, you're not.
Yeah, you have to hit cancel and then hit skip on the dialogue that pops up.
Yeah, and so that's the part I wanted to add. And
all right, sorry about that. Shoot. Oh, yeah, so add for me, that's what we were talking about. The double tilde, if you please. I would.
That is very unlikely to happen.
But
why don't you just put use Unicode strike through, Casey? Get around the system just like Adam.
I thought about it. For a hot second, I really did think about it. But
can't you just Unicode strike kind of sucks. But... Like you can just write the tag.
I thought strike tag.
If you're allowed to write HTML, you just do an HTML.
Yeah, just
start with Markdown Madness.
I always do it with fucking spans and CSS. But I thought I didn't realize that strike was still. I thought
HTML
like
is valid anywhere in Markdown. You know, that's Gruber's big escape hatch of saying, "Don't blame me. You can just write HTML."
I literally just said I used a span tag. What I'm saying is, I thought blink and strike were of the same ilk. Like you are not supposed to be using blink.
I think strike is like
you do
with CSS. It's like you could do it. Like there, it's maybe frowned upon, but it works.
You're just using CSS. It's HTML and CSS. That's all it is.
That's literally what I did. That's what I did. I used HTML with CSS. That's what I did. You're looking at it right now, for Christ's sakes.
No, I'm not, because I have to hit reload.
Anyway. All right. So I'm not. It is not in the official Markdown spec, from what I can tell. Where's the data?
I'm so old. I used a TT tag and some HTML I was writing the other day, and the validator yelled at me. The validator basically said, "You're old. Stop using TT. We don't do that anymore, old person. Stop it." I'm like, all right, fine.
Yep, not allowed.
They said, "Have you considered using KBD?" I'm like, no, I have not considered using KBD.
According to Gruber's dingus, it is not allowed. So I will give you half credit, Marco.
There you go.
GitHub flavored Markdown. That's where I look next, personally. Strike. Oh, yep, there it is. Strike through. GFM enables a strike through extension where an additional emphasis type is available. Strike through text is any text wrap with a matching
pair. Slack does single tildes for strike through, doesn't it?
It looks. I thought it was two only, but apparently, according to GFM, it is actually one or two tildes.
Because Slack doesn't use Markdown. Slack uses some Slack thing, right?
Yeah, well, it's because it reverses bold and it reverses bold and italic. I forget what else it does, but it's annoying. Yeah, Slack is very wrong about Markdown. Also, for the love of all that is good and holy, when are they going to fix the thing when I'm in like the relay Slack and I type at Marco and hit a space?
Yeah,
when are they going to make that actually, you know, be a hyperlink or whatever?
It does 50% of the time.
No, bull. It works 10% of the time.
I'm about at 50-50.
Oh, you're full of shit, sir. No.
Yeah, no. Because the thing is, I know sometimes it doesn't work, and if you backspace over it and try it again, it will work. It's just inexplicable.
It's so bad. It makes me absolutely nuts. That's right. All right. So are we good here? Anything else for live people?
I think we're good.
All right, goodbye, live people.
Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you,
One last thing. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, regular time next week. If you are a Tweetbot or Twitterific person, we should put this on the show.
No,
I didn't even think about this.
I'm sure you can talk about it on the talk show.
No, we didn't.
Well, either way.
No,
either
you
way.
Have.
Well, it wasn't. Well, I don't think it was out yet.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. All right. The point is, if you are a Tweetbot or Twitterific person who had a subscription, go and re-download the app. Not kidding. Go to the App Store, re-download the app. And then it'll ask you, do you want a prorated refund? In the case of Tweetbot, do you want to push that over to Ivory? Or do you want to say, I'm good, don't worry about it? And for all of us, I reckon we can afford to say, I'm good. You could, I think, do the Ivory thing. But you know what? I already subscribed to Ivory. And I still said, I'm good. Because it's a few bucks of my money. It's not that much money for me. But in aggregate, that's a metric shitload for Tapbots. And same thing for Icon Factory. So if you have even just a handful of dollars that you can spare, why don't you say no refund, please? It would really mean a lot to them.
Yeah, because here's the thing. If you don't go reinstall Tweetbot and Twitterific and opt out of the refund, the default will be that they're going to have this money taken out of their bank accounts. That's going to be taken by them and refunded to customers for whatever time was left on their subscriptions because, Twitter, blew up. So this is like, this is potentially a huge negative pull of money out of these companies. Like this, I mean, this could bankrupt people. Like this is not a good scene. And so if you can opt out of getting this refund, please do so. So go install Tweetbot or Twitterific again. You might have deleted it already. Go install it again and go to the, and it open, they open, each one of them opens up to a similar screen that just says, hey, here's the deal. What do you want to do? If you do nothing, you will get a prorated refund for any unused time on that subscription. That will come from the developers. If you opt out, they will lose less money. So please go install these apps again and opt out of those refunds if you can.
I never uninstalled it. I actually put Twitterific into my phone's dock, which is an area that I don't use. So it's just a little museum. Yeah, so I like the icon. But then I went in there.
How do you
and
not
I,
use like it's?
I know.
It's,
I don't find it an easy place to reach. I don't find that's
it's
like
the
a
easiest nope. place to reach.
I don't think so. The way I hold my phone, I find that incredibly awkward. I've never put anything that I used in the dock, which is, you know, whatever. Kind of a shame. It's always visible, but I just
are
I can't
you like
reach
a center
easily.
Grip person, not like a lower grip person?
I mean, I guess so. I mean, but I find it. Not, I can't reach that. I guess my grip is just up too high. Anyway, I put Twitterific in there because I just wanted to, you know, it's a place of honor, and I just wanted to continue to see the icon. Right, I replaced it with Ivory. On
it is
actual,
a really nice icon
on my home screen. I have a set to a slightly different than, you know, it's a customizable icon. Anyway, but then when they came out with this thing, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go do it and say I don't need a refund, and then I realized I don't have a subscription because I'm on the beta, and the beta is just like perpetually subscribed. You know what I mean? But then I didn't feel too bad because I think I paid like $150 for Twitter for Mac. So when they had the Kickstarter, so I'm good.
Fair enough. All right, this time for real.
And
goodbye,
I subscribe
to Icon
Factor's
Patreon,
which you should do.
Yeah.
All right, for real this time. Goodbye, live people.
Bye, live people.